People assume that time is a strict progression of cause to effect, but actually, from a non-linear, non-subjective viewpoint, it's more like a big ball of wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey.
From days of long ago, from uncharted regions of the universe, comes a legend.
Tell me, Doctor, where are we going next time? Is this the 50s or 1999?
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. It's time. The Fandom Podcast Network proudly presents the Fandom Flashback.
My calculations are correct. When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're gonna see some serious.
Welcome to Fandom Podcast Network special presentation of Fandom Flashback 1986, the movies 30 years later. In this special edition of the Fandom Flashback, we will cover the year in movies for 1986. Could this possibly be the best year in movies? We will debate this in this four-part special. Welcome to part four of the Fandom Flashback 1986, the movies. In this episode, we will cover the movies released in the months of October, November, and December of 1986. I'm Kevin. I'm one of your hosts. And I'd like to introduce my co-host for this time travel journey to 1986. First and foremost, Mr. Davis Grayson, how are you? And welcome.
Thank you, sir. How are you doing tonight? It's a wonderful night tonight.
Ah, man, I'm glad to have you. I'm excited about this. I'm excited to have you on this particular episode for a special reason. You're going to go over some toys, aren't you, later?
Indeed, I am. I'm looking forward to seeing what even y'all collected in 1986.
Oh, yes. That was a good year. Good year. Our other co-host, I kind of know this guy. We talked a little Highlander from time to time. My fellow Blood of Kings host, Mr. Norman Centauri Lau. How are you, sir?
It is fantastic to be here amongst all you incredible people.
Oh, no. We got Lopan back. Oh, shoot.
Lopan is failing us.
It's 1986, fools.
Okay. Please let Norman loose. I mean, we really want him back. We love to have your presence from time to time. You shined in the last one, but come on.
Oh, fine. Very well. I'll release this pitiful fool. Hello, everyone. I'm glad to be here tonight, and I'm not exactly sure where the last 20 minutes have gone, but I assure you, I was up to probably no good.
Well, welcome, Norm. How are you, my friend?
I'm great. This is actually a great undertaking that you've done here, Kevin. Four parts for 1986, which is obviously for all of us recording tonight, is a very special year for us. So I'm glad that we were able to see this entire project through.
Well, I appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun, and it's been a pet project and something that's been fun to do. But, you know, we still got room for one more awesome dude, and that is our fellow Fandom Podcast Network co-founder and my co-host of Culture Clash and The End Zone, Mr. Kyle Wagner. How are you?
I am doing good. We've got a super moon out. I had my flea bath, so when I transform later, it's all going to be good, and I am ready to talk some 1986.
That's no moon.
Well, Rogue One maybe, is right, imminent. Know, right?
Flea bath. Oh, jeez.
Super werewolf.
Yeah.
Well, I also wanted to say, coming up later in the show, we're gonna have a special 1986 Aussie report from Alan R. Ryan of Oz Fans Radio down there in Australia. I talked with him briefly, and we're gonna have him on to kind of give us what was going on with him for 1986. He's a big fan of the movies, and 1986 was definitely a banner year, and I'm looking forward to having him give us his feedback on that. So,
but did he play Connery or Kane with you? Was there no Connery or Kane? Did Alan O'Ryan play Connery or Kane with you?
We have played that game before, and I've not been very good at it, but we do have a little fun with some trivia, I believe. So we'll let you guys listen to that later. First of all, thank you again, guys, for joining me for the Fandom Flashback. This is, like I said, this is a project that's been near and dear to my heart, and it's been a great special for debate. And you know, is this the best year of movies? And we touched on that in the last few episodes, and teased what's coming up next, and we'll get into that later. But first, let's take a step back in time to 1986. Let's fuel up that DeLorean with a flux capacitor, slingshot around the sun aboard a captured Klingon bird of prey, which we'll have a little extra meeting this episode. Take a step into that blue police box as we travel back to 1986 and remind us of what was happening in pop culture, sports, and politics in the middle of this decade of decadence. Guys, can you remind me real quick, in the 80s, what was some other popular time travel devices, if any? Do you remember?
Cocaine.
Well,
scientists,
yes, okay.
That's a hell of a drug.
That's right.
Well, now, if we are going 1980s, we got to hit in 1989 because Quantum Leaps started in 1989.
Ziggy.
That's
for
okay.
Sure.
Yeah. Good point.
Also the Omni from Voyagers and the flux capacitor, for sure.
Yes, of course, yeah. Flux capacitor. Yeah. Okay. All right.
And cocaine.
Well, of course, back in 1986, Reagan was our president and gas was cheaper, and of course, we had the Chicago Bears beating the New England Patriots, and there was that whole was that the Super Bowl shuffle, right? Super Bowl shuffle?
Yeah, I'm trying to
William
forget
Refrigerator
that,
Perry.
Jim McMahon and his sunglasses.
That's right, yeah. Boston Celtics won their NBA championship. New York Mets won theirs. I want to talk a little bit about music real quick. I had alluded to earlier in the last three episodes that the first 10 musicians were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And without you guys looking at the notes, Norm, can you name a couple on here?
Marvin Berry and the Starlighters?
Marvin Berry, your cousin.
Oh, his cousin. Chuck Berry. Chuck Berry.
Yes. Chuck Berry, James Brown, Ray Charles, Sam Cooke, Fats Domino, the Everly Brothers, Don Everly and Phil Everly, Buddy Holly, Jerry Lee Lewis, Little Richard, and Elvis Presley.
That is legendary.
That is a pretty good opening there to open up the doors to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame there in Cleveland.
This was the first class.
Yes.
Yes, this is the first class in 1986. That's when it started.
That's epic. That's pretty epic.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's interesting how the names that they got on here. There's some of these that are a definite walk-in. Like Elvis is like, just give me the keys, you know?
have any of you guys actually been into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland?
Have not had the pleasure.
I was there once years ago, and because my family's from Northeast Ohio. And the reason why it's there in Cleveland because, and I don't remember the name of the radio DJ, but the radio DJ at WNBC actually coined the phrase rock and roll for the very first time in Cleveland. So that's why the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is actually in Cleveland. That's really
that is
nice.
On one of my bucket lists.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. They had like a nice little tribute there to a lot of things in 1980. They had a picture of the very first Sony Walkman. It was pretty neat to see like some of the old technology there.
That's awesome. They I assume they have a lot of memorabilia there as well. You know,
tons.
Like, it's kind of like walking into a much better Hard Rock Cafe.
Yeah, it's like Hard Rock Cafe on steroids. You know, they had Elvis Presley's TCB with a lightning flash revolvers, the ones that he like wore, and one of them he gave Nixon. They had the Beatles, Sgt. Pepper stuff. I mean, it's like it's Mecca for music.
For those of you who don't know, if you haven't been to Graceland, TCB was taking care of business
in a flash.
That was his business. That was his business motto. You know, he was a smart businessman. He was there to entertain but make money as well. So you'll see that everywhere if you go to Graceland. It's a lot of fun, especially if you go on his plane. You'll see that as well. 1986, popular music acts were Robert Palmer, Van Halen, Police, Whitney Houston, Bruce Springsteen, Prince, Culture Club, Madonna with Papa Don't Preach, and the Bengals, Walk Like an Egyptian. But I want to start getting into the toys here, Davis. 1986 gave us some memorable toys like the Watchable Watches, Nintendo NES, Omnibot 2000, the My Buddy Dolls. Now, I got to tell you guys real something. You may have saw my Facebook feed today, but I showed my daughter Camille Short Circuit for the first time. And at the end of the credits, and I wouldn't have really noticed this if I wasn't paying attention to IMDb, they show some scenes. It's like a montage of a lot of the stuff you had seen in the film and the credits. But there are some cut scenes that were not in the film that make it into that montage and the credits. And one of them is Johnny Five talking to what I believe is an Omnibot, like a toy. And there's a couple other scenes in there as well. But she really enjoyed the film. It was nice to go down memory lane. It was nice that the movie was like only an hour and a half long. So if you got a short attention span and you're 11, it definitely went by really quick. But it was fun to share that with her. But Davis, I'd like to introduce you in the toy segment here of 1986. I want you to take us back to what was going on with toys.
Well, picture this: 1986, Georgia. A young lad on an October morning afternoon gets the mail, and he has in the mail right now a Sears wish book. How many people remember the Sears wish book?
Every year, Sears and JCPenney's.
Yes, every year. So just imagine all of a sudden starting to flip through, you know, the pictures that I showed you earlier. It started bringing back memories of saying, oh, I need to dog tag this page. I need to circle this because you were already making your Christmas list as it was. And in 1986, there was a lot of cool things that was being released. And does anyone know what some of the hot things were at the time?
Well, I'm going to guess.
Not the GoBots.
G.I. Joe? Say,
damn it. Well, G.I. Joe was one of them. But there was.
Transformers.
There was a few different ones. Transformers was also, but it was also a year for exclusives and a year for big play sets. So at that time, Eternia was released from He-Man.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, remember that? I remember Castle Grayskull, but what was Eternia?
Eternia had, it was like a monorail train that would go on top, and it was like one mountain and then like a couple other pillars that would be around. It was a humongous playset.
Davis, would you say that Eternia was along the lines of like the G.I. Joe base, like that kind of size?
I would probably say at least the size bigger. Of a pterodrome.
Yeah, it's a pterodrome.
Yeah. Well, I would say that's safe to assume right there.
Well, one interesting thing about Eternia, it's actually still to this day one of the most sought after play sets because it was extremely rare. Yes, Kevin, even more rare than the USS flag.
Get out!
Yep.
The USS flag is a myth.
And
serious? Okay, hold on. That's saying a lot because the flag is the flag, okay? The flag is huge. It was 7 feet long or whatever it was. Is Eternia more rare because because of its availability? What made it rare?
Its availability was one thing. I know that a boxed one just sold on eBay for about $7,000.
I think it was also it was not made to order. That's not the right thing to say. It was you had to pre-order. You had to get a pre-order sales in order for them to manufacture because it costs so damn much.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Wow. And you know, what's really funny is when we look at how all the different play sets was, if you remember the toy line Mask, Boulder Hill, their headquarters was also released that year. And now what's the next one to release was the Pterodrome, of course, which was probably one of the more sought after headquarters as well, because it was actually finally a Cobra base.
Also, Cobra Pterodrome.
And what's so cool about it, I mean, I finally was able to achieve greatness by getting one back in 2010. I finally scored one. And let me tell you, it was one of the coolest items because it just brought back all the memories that I had when I was 11, finally able to have a Pterodrome. So
if I remember correctly, the Terradrome was logistically a better base because the G.I. Joe base was one-sided, and if you wanted to attack it, you just had to go around behind them. Where the Terradrome was like in a circle, and it had all parts around it.
Wait fortified. A second. You're supposed to put the base up against a mountainside, yeah, so it had exactly. No rear. But it was flat.
The mountain didn't keep my ninjas away. So
now here's the thing I remember about the Terradrome too was what I thought was so cool about it was you had the Firebat plane which took off out of the middle of the Terradrome.
And that is one of the yes. coolest features right there. The only thing about the Terradrome that would be a downside to it, since the top part is the head is like the command center, there is no top for that. But that's also the play availability. That's just using your imagination saying it's covered.
Right.
You know.
Okay, I want to make sure we get through a lot of these toys here before we get on to the next segment here. Can you guys talk about Silverhawks? I am not having a huge memory on Silverhawks here. Davis?
Tally-ho.
Yeah,
This was actually Tally based Hawk. In the 26th century, I want to say. And it was against a villain named Monstar, who was he was a very evil person, if I remember correctly. And the Silverhawks were actually genetically enhanced, if I remember correctly,
cyborgs.
To take on. Yeah, they were cyborgs. To take on. Their leader was named Stargazer. Or like their Professor X tile, and then their leader's name was Quicksilver. And then another name was Bluegrass.
He had a guitar. Bluegrass had a guitar.
Yeah. Yes,
flew the ship with the guitar, and then you had the Steel Twins.
Yes, yes.
Why did I not see this show? I must have been watching Inspector Gadget or something instead, because this ran for 65 episodes. I don't even remember this.
Basically, after like Voltron established that the 5-to-1. You know, the ratio, it was a huge format for success. And then you had Thundercats. And, you know, it's funny because Thundercats had Mum-Ra and then Silverhawks had Monstar. And it was just kind of like, I wouldn't say they're like terrible ripoffs, but they're just kind of like, it's kind of like what Street Hawk was to Knight Rider.
Yeah. Let me explain this to you, Norman, because I actually went to a panel on this at Dragon Con. There were three shows by the same animation group. Thundercats, Silverhawks, and a show called Street Sharks.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Thundercats and Silverhawks were the two main popular series. And the very cool thing about the Silverhawks toys was they were so shiny, and they can never make those again because they can't use that kind of paint on toys anymore.
Are they toxic?
They were, yeah. Well, it was toxic paint. But the figures... What was cool about them is especially the Silverhawks themselves, you squeeze their legs, their arms extended out, and they had wings.
Oh, my God. Those were amazing. That's right.
Go ahead.
You know, I was going to say, the only other problem with them was they had zero articulation.
Yep.
Davis, now, I know you got some other stuff on here. You got Centurions, Inhumans, I remember Inhumans, Centurions. I'm a little hazy on that one as well.
Centurions, they were the ones that started off much like G.I. Joe. They had a 5-part miniseries, and they went for like 60 episodes, I want to say, as well. And it was three members of the team, which is kind of funny because their names was Ace McCloud, Jake Rockwell, and Max Ray, which if you look in other terms, it's air, land, and sea. And they're the ones that actually had... the exosuits.
Power Extreme.
Power Extreme.
Exactly. Now, I will tell you, you want to hear, you know, we have been talking about recently about the Hasbro Cinematic Universe.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right, let's go back to the 80s where the Hasbro Cinematic TV Universe actually already started. And the way I say that is because G.I. Joe was connected to Transformers. Jim and the Holograms was connected, and now in Humanoids.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Does anybody know who that person was that connected them all together?
Wasn't it Cobra Commander?
Close. It was none other than reporter Hector Ramirez.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Wow.
How funny is that? He was based off a...
what was that reporter's name who was looking for Al
Capone? Geraldo Rivera.
Geraldo Rivera. Made it okay, was based based on him.
When was Hector Ramirez in G.I. Joe?
It was on 20 Questions. It was the episode, I believe it was in 1985, when Dusty was a traitor, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
I could be totally off by that.
Wow. You
but he was on at the time.
Is he worth doing a cosplay?
Yeah. And here's the really funny thing about it is there is people to this day is hoping, because the G.I. Joe Club was renewed for 2 more years, there's people hoping that they actually release a figure of Hector Ramirez. Wow. Because, I mean, he brought that. Now, here's another little tidbit of knowledge, too. Of the Inhumanoids, the one called Brad J. Armbuster, who was also the code name of Saberjet, that is actually the same name as Ace, who piloted the Sky Striker.
Oh, no way.
Yes.
You're killing me, dude. You're killing me. Wow. You're amazing.
All right, so when we talk about different things with G.I. Joe, Transformers, you know, the one cool thing about it is there was a lot of exclusives, especially during this year. There was also the Dreadnoughts from Sears. There was, from Toys R Us, there was the Mission Brazil team. Does anybody remember that one?
No.
It was the introduction of Captain Claymore, and it was Leatherneck, Wetsuit, Dial Tone, and Mainframe. And wow. It came with an audio tape of the mission, of the Brazilian mission.
Were these like sent in with like proofs of purchase? Is that the way that you got these exclusives?
No. The Dreadnought one was the Sears exclusive that you could actually order from the catalog. And then the Mission Brazil was available at Toys R Us.
Okay.
Yeah. Wow. So,
now, I have a quick question for you, Davis, about exclusives. Was this the year that the Sears catalog did the Crimson Guard exclusives, where they did a couple of the old G.I. Joe vehicles and recolored them red and black? Because I remember there was a Mobat version of a Crimson Guard tank that was a Sears exclusive.
I think it may have been this year, but I do know the Dreadnought set was out this year because they used a Vamp, or was it a Stinger? And it was a Skyhawk that was released in Dreadnought colors. So... And, you know, the really cool thing about it is, I don't know if anybody remembers this, but there was a controversy on two of the toy lines. Does anybody remember which toy controversy it was?
Was it Mask one of them with the small masks that they had with the kids?
No, it was something even more broader range. It was the Ghostbusters.
Oh, yes.
What was wrong with the Ghostbusters?
It was an IP issue, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was, because remember there was an old TV show back in the 70s called The Ghostbusters.
There was The Ghostbusters and The Real Ghostbusters.
Yes. Yep. So they, and both their toy lines was released at this time, and both their cartoons was going on and everything. So, I mean, it was really funny how the movie from 1985, was it? Ghostbusters?
84.
Or was it 84? 84. They were known as the Real Ghostbusters, and
right.
The TV show was known as just the Ghostbusters.
I had no idea. That's wow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to wrap this all up, if we look back in the 1980s, we had, let me just tell you the toy lines we had, all the different companies. We had Kenner, Hasbro, Matchbox, Tonka, RKS Design, and, you know, Nintendo. And, you know, after the 80s was over, everyone started consolidating. Kenner actually joined forces with Hasbro, Tonker as well. Also, there was Hot Wheels as well. But if you go down memory lane and look at all the different toy sections, there was so much product within those years that if you said, I want an Optimus Prime, you could almost go to a different toy store and say, oh, there's Optimus right there. And now these days, the distribution, you know, love it or hate it, it's not the best. So, you know, it's one of those things where if you don't pick it up now, you're not going to get it later.
You know, just to jump in here, I mean, I got to agree with you on that, because when I was younger, there was a place, a vendor called Children's Palace in Ohio. And you could like walk in there and get anything you want, or you could go to Toys R Us. This is before like Toys R Us or any of like these exclusive change. And I feel it. It's kind of like it's almost sad in a way that you have to kind of like stake your claim and find exclusives, or go to a comic book store and pay like triple the price. I mean, I think that's ridiculous. I mean, they're toys, for God's sake.
Yeah. I completely agree with you, because, you know, if you think about it, I mean, even now, just like with the Star Wars Black Series, just trying to find an Ahsoka is
yeah
probably or one the, of the hardest things.
Or the droid from Rogue One, the K.
Not that hard to find. I can find him on a pretty regular basis.
Yeah, that one's Black getting series? A little easier. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, for the other toys you have mentioned here, yeah, Teddy Ruck's been on there. That was the bear that was kind of interactive with the cassette tape, and you could record your own stuff. If I remember,
is that what they based Ted off of?
I think so.
I should have just got a Teddy Ruxpin.
Yeah. Now wait. I have a question. Did any of you guys know people who had a Teddy Ruxpin, or did you have a Teddy Ruxpin?
I did not. I knew someone that did.
Now, any of you that knew somebody who had a Teddy Ruxpin, you know you put that AC/DC cassette inside Teddy Ruxpin.
I tortured my sister to death.
I wanted to put Styx, Mr. Roboto in there. That's what I wanted to do. Well, okay, look, you also mentioned you got Rock Lords on here. I remember those. I want to touch briefly before we move on to from the toys here. I want to touch on the Nintendo NES games that were released here. And I'm looking at some of these games. Now, classics. To clarify, were all these released in 86, Davis?
Yes. From what I saw, that was the ones released. And did everyone get a Nintendo when it was first released or no?
No, I did not. I had to wait till a couple of years later.
Yeah, I think it was about 88 before I had a Nintendo.
I want to say it was like either 87 or 88 for me.
I see 1942, Balloon Flight, which almost looks like it looks kind of similar to the Super Mario Brothers. Then there was Chiller, Chubby Cherub, Commando. That was one of my favorites. Awesome. Donkey Kong, Donkey Kong 3, Donkey Kong Jr. There was a lot that came out. The Ghost and Goblins, the Goonies came out. Gumshoe, that's right. Karate Champ
Muscle. Was awesome.
I don't remember Muscle. Do you guys remember Muscle?
It was a wrestling game. I remember the figures that came out.
Yeah, I remember all the little figures that actually came out.
Was that based off those little bitty plastic pink figures that came out?
Yep.
Then there
also
was
probably made of toxic plastic as well.
Of course, they show Mario Brothers, Ninja Kid. I don't remember Ninja Kid. Davis, do you remember Ninja Kid?
I do not. I don't remember a lot of these games. I mean, 1942, of course, that was a given. Commando. I never got Commando, but I got the sequel to it, Bionic Commando.
Yes. And then Popeye came out.
Yeah, I remember Popeye.
Tag Team Wrestling, Urban Commando. Wow.
Now, guys, I got to throw out, because I can't remember if it came out in 86 or not, but there was a Sega put out the Sega Master System, which was direct competition to the Nintendo Entertainment System. And what I remember about that was two games in particular, OutRun and the game Space Harrier.
Oh, Space Harrier was amazing. Amazing. Oh,
to this day, nobody has put out a remake of Space Harrier is beyond me.
I don't remember Space Harrier.
Oh, I'm trying to remember which one that one is.
Sometimes these assistants were so expensive that you had to kind of make friends with people sometimes who weren't really friendly with at school, right? Because you knew that they had the system. Then you had to kind of beg your parents. It's like, well, I'm going over to so-and-so's house for his homework. And then all of a sudden it's not homework. It's because they had the system, right?
Oh, now, absolutely.
I don't think we can move on unless we touch on Robotech and Transformers real quick. You mentioned that Transformers had a brand new lineup.
Was the brand new lineup. I think Kyle and I might know a little bit about this. This was also the year that it came out, the year the Transformers the movie came out, which actually probably scarred a lot of kids our age, knowing it was the, spoiler alert, death of Optimus Prime.
Shall stand, one shall fall.
Why throw away your life so recklessly?
And Rodimus Prime was in full swing, even though he was a futuristic Winnebago.
You got the power.
Are we talking Lone Star Winnebago here?
No, not quite that level. But here's the thing about that Transformers line in 1986, and this is why I remember it so much, because that Christmas was the year of Transformers for me. I think I got action figures for almost every character that was in the movie that year. And here's the kicker on this. The Transformers that came out later, all the ones based off the movie compared to the initial run of Transformers, were statuesque, and I mean that literally. They had no articulation at all. The Rodimus Prime figure was literally a stick robot inside of a Winnebago case.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it was really funny is the movie was not released until July, right?
Right.
Okay. My birthday, I received a Rodimus Prime.
What month is your birthday?
It's in May. So The toy line was already out before the movie even happened. So you have no idea as a kid going, who is this Rodimus Prime and why does he look like Hot Rod?
Yeah.
Because Cup was also released at that same time too. So you're going, what's happening?
No. I'll even give you the better kicker and just how crazy the end of the Transformer line got. The Ultra Magnus figure was as big as the Metroplex figure.
That's right. Yes, it was. Well,
Davis, was there any other toys you wanted to touch on?
No, I think we got it. I mean, well, real quickly, just go around the horn real quick. What was the toy line that really you loved, or if you were still collecting toys in 1986? Kevin, let's start with you.
For me, it was all about the G.I. Joes, you know, and of course, playing my friend's Nintendo games, because I didn't have a Nintendo. I didn't have Atari. I didn't get that stuff till later. But it was all about the G.I. Joe and, you know, watching the TV shows. So that was my wheelhouse. What about you? What about you, Norman?
And for toy lines, I would probably have to say Masters of the Universe. Because I really did like Masters of the Universe. I love the mini comics that came in there, and they have that really nice compilation that they released of all of the mini comic books that came with every single figure. I don't think they did the She-Ra line, the Princess of Power, but I did love those Masters of the Universe figures. I thought they were super cool, and I love the movie, so.
Kyle, what about you?
Well, Norman, 86 was an interesting year for Masters of the Universe, because that was kind of the end of the line for that. But for me, it's almost a three-way tie, because G.I. Joe and Transformers were so formative. But to this day, I think I got more pleasure playing with the Mask toys and that toy line. There was just so much fun there. But, I mean, G.I. Joe, Transformers, Mask, I think it's a pretty close three-way tie with those. And, of course, at the time I'm living in Alaska, you got a lot of winter days to occupy your time when it's 60 below outside. So,
I have one small question. Do you think that without the animation vehicles to drive sales, do you think that the toy lines, they kind of went by the wayside as soon as the animation started to dry up?
Yes, because if you look at some of the side toy lines like Chuck Norris Karate Commandos, you know, that only lasted for just a little while or anything. I think 80s was probably one of the perfect examples of saying, in order for a toy line to be successful, you need to have a cartoon with it, or you need to have some other type of media to it.
It was the perfect marriage for kids, because you got to see your toys come to life. You got, you know, live out the adventures. It was a great time to grow up with, you know, celebrating your toys and also to sell toys. Perfect way to do that.
I got to add in, too, at least in the case of G.I. Joe and Transformers, you had two excellent comic books running as well. So,
yeah, true.
Yeah, those were both in the Marvel house, right?
Correct.
Yes, they were.
Yeah.
Now, Davis, I wanted to mention real quick, you had given us a link to the Wish book JCPenney catalog, and I want to touch on one thing I found in that was the price – was the price of VCRs back then.
Oh, this brings back bad memories, Kevin.
Yes, this is a story I heard firsthand from your parents when we had that lovely afternoon with them. But these are cheaper compared to those, because I think you got yours like, you know, 5 years earlier than these came out. But in 86, there's a beautiful VHS here going for $589.
Oh my God! In 1986 dollars?
Yes, and it was cut. $100 was cut off that price too.
Wow.
Yeah, and there's some other ones here for. Oh, here's the cheap one for $279.99. Yeah. There's one here for $329 and another one for $359. So yeah, and there's some TV deals here. Oh, wait, here's a beautiful one for $529.
What? Who's the manufacturer?
You know what? I can't really tell with the imagery here, but look, it's. I don't know if that's on purpose, but I'm not seeing an actual. It just says on-screen display on one of them. But yeah, the manufacturers either they're kind of hiding that because it's coming through. Their catalog or something. I'm not sure, but it doesn't say it like they, you know, when you would see them in person and stuff. Yeah. So, but, they're very beautiful though. And there's a great handheld camera here for $1,000.
Oh my God.
Well, real quick before we hit the movies of 1986, just to give you guys an idea, cause Kevin heard the story real quick. I won't go into the full detail, but I think it was about 82. My dad bought a VCR with my sister, which almost ended their lives with my mom. But they paid $1,000 for J.C. Penney VCR in 1982.
Oh, my God. Holy crap.
Yeah, your mom wasn't happy, bro.
I just hid in my room.
Kyle was like, yes.
That was 1986 money?
82 money.
82. Oh.
But give you an idea. The remote control on this VCR was attached via about a 25-foot cable.
Cord. Yep. Yeah. Yep. They were still connected. Yep.
Well, Davis,
no,
I want
no IR on that. Yep.
Davis, I want to thank you for letting us go down memory lane with the toys. Appreciate the research you put into that. And man, there's some good stuff on there. So thank you. Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, let's get into the movies here. Again, this is the final part four of the 1986 flashback for these films. Let's go into October here. And, we've got Children of a Lesser God, which is October 3rd with Tough Guys. October 10th, we had Jumpin' Jack Flash, Peggy Sue Got Married, True Stories, Deadly Friend. October 17th, we had The Color of Money. October 24th, we had Trick or Treat, Soul Man. And October 31st on Halloween, we had Let's Get Harry. Davis, I want to start with you. One of these movies jump out at you that you'd like to talk about?
The only one that I remember was Children of a Lesser God, and mainly the reason because Marley Matlin, who is deaf, she, my mom at the time was really an interpreter for not only our church and for where she works and everything, but it was just really cool to see the interaction of, you know, of the person who was actually deaf and how the other person tried to communicate with her. So, I mean, it was good because I was also learning sign language at the time too. Unfortunately, I don't remember some of it, but I know a little bit here and there, but I had the pleasure of seeing Marley Matlin at Epcot when she did the candlelight procession.
Oh,
and
wow.
She actually, she would be her interpreter, but she signed everything she did. So it was actually really cool to see that. So
she went on to win the best supporting actress, right?
Yes, she did.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. What about you, Norm? What jumps out at you this month?
Well, I love Children of a Lesser God because again, that was Marley Matlin. And I believe that was John Hurt or William Hurt. William Hurt was in that. But for me in this whole group here, The Color of Money is probably my favorite because I'm a huge fan of The Hustler. You know, that original 1950 something black and white movie,
yeah.
with Paul Newman and the great one, Jackie Gleason as Minnesota Fats. And that was a fantastic movie. And this is the sequel.
Yeah. It came out in 1961.
1961. Okay. So this is the sequel of The Hustler. And it brings back Paul Newman as Fast Eddie Felsen, and he brings on his protege, which is Tom Cruise. Now, Tom Cruise is pretty much he's red hot right now.
Top Gun is still playing in the theaters.
Yeah.
So he is red hot right now. He played a character, a new hustler named Vince. Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio was his girlfriend. I love this movie. It's It was also directed by Martin Scorsese, I believe.
Yes.
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 And it was just, I liked seeing kind of like the not so much the end of Fast Eddie Felsen, but kind of like the continuation of his story. And so many years later, I mean, talk about a delayed sequel. But also it gave us that really great song by Eric Clapton. It's in the way that you use it.
Yeah.
It's in the way that you use it. Bum, 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 bum. I mean, that's a great anthem from like the mid-1980s. And I don't know. I love playing pool. I love The Hustler. I love seeing this sequel. So it was great.
And what also to point out.
Sorry. Go ahead, Davis. Go ahead.
I was just going to point out John Turturro was also in that, if you remember him from Transformer fame.
Oh, that's right. Hmm. And there's Steve Mizorak. He played against Fast Eddie Felsen, and he goes, I didn't deserve that. Steve Mizorak was like the guy at the time. Like he was the nine ball player. Oh, yeah. And that's right. It went from straight eight to nine ball because nine ball was like the big format at the time.
Kyle, what about you? What jumps at you in this month?
Well, also like Norman, The Color of Money. Another one that stands out to me, you got to go Jumpin' Jack Flash.
Yeah.
Whoopi Goldberg coming on the scene with Jumpin' Jack Flash. What a fun movie. Made us all kind of the first movie that really truly used IMs and internet connection for conversations.
And you know who directed that film, right?
Oh, remind me off the top because I got it right on the tip of my tongue.
Penny Marshall.
That's right, Penny Marshall. But you know, as great as Jumpin' Jack Flash was, I you can't not mention C. Thomas Howe going blackface for Soul Man.
Okay, so let me ask you something about Soul this, Man. Guys. So, now wasn't the premise of this movie that he took some type of medication that like increased like the darkness of his skin?
No, if I remember correctly, what it was he was trying to get into a particular college.
Uh-huh. He was trying to attend Harvard.
But mm-hmm. He couldn't get in via a regular scholarship. He got in with a minority scholarship into this particular program. He usually used like a makeup job, professional makeup job to make himself.
Okay. So this was kind of like the Bosom Buddies / Sorority Girls version of trying to get into the role reversal. But you can't get away with a movie like that today.
No.
Now, the cast, of course, Radon Chong, she was in this. Ari Gross, James Earl Jones, Leslie Nielsen was in it as well. But yeah, you know, C. Thomas Howell was riding high on a lot of stuff. Of course, he was in Red Dawn, a bunch of other films. But yeah, this is a film that you cannot make today.
unless it was reversed.
Yes,
unless
that's
it was
true.
Reversed. And like, yeah. like Eddie Murphy does or like Dave Chappelle does.
You know, for me personally, definitely the Soul Man jumps out at me. And I remember Jumpin' Jack Flash. The one movie I remember, too, because my father was a big fan of these guys, was Tough Guys, starring Burt Lancaster and Kurt Douglas. Yeah. These are two elderly gangsters that are released from prison. They kind of get in their shenanigans again. Now, these guys are legendary actors, and I remember watching a lot of these guys' films back in the day. Of course, Kurt Douglas in Spartacus and Burt Lancaster and plenty other swashbuckling films and stuff like that. But this was kind of like their last hurrah, the last time these guys got together to do a movie like this. And I remember seeing that actually with my family. I think we all went to go see it at the drive-in. So that was a lot of fun for me. Before we move on to November, anyone else want to jump in on anything else in October? You guys good?
Well, Peggy Sue Got Married also was kind of like a very popular film amongst a certain audience. I know that. I mean, Kathleen yep. Turner was really great in that, and I think Nicolas Cage is in that also.
I'm glad you brought that up because that movie was very popular. Mm-hmm. I don't remember seeing this in the theater though, but it was directed by Francis Ford Coppola.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Nicolas Cage was in there.
Also his nephew, so that's why he probably got the job.
I'm looking at the list here. You know who else was in that film? Was Jim Carrey.
Earlier on, yeah. He got some bit roles here and there. I mean, In Living Color was kind of like getting bigger at the time, right? Or was it on by then?
That was later.
That was later.
Wasn't he known as James Carrey back then?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Well, let's jump into November here. November 7th of November of 1986, we've had 52 Pickup, Modern Girls, Sid and Nancy, Something Wild, Taipan. November 8th, we had Quiet Cool. November 12th, we had a movie called Heat. November 14th, we had Hoosiers and Streets of Gold. November 21st, we had An American Tale. Oh. We had Firewalker. We had The Wraith. I think that was with Charlie Sheen. November 26th, we had The Mosquito Coast, Nutcracker, Solar Babies, some Star Trek for The Voyage Home.
I'll hurt you.
And November 28th, we had a movie called Eye of the Tiger. Norman, I'm going to go straight to you on this one. I know which one you want to talk about.
Well, I want to talk about Star Trek 4, but I love Hoosiers. So someone can
do
pick
both.
Hoosiers.
Go ahead.
Well, okay, so Star Trek 4, it's the culmination of what we would call the soft Star Trek trilogy, which started in 1982 with Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and then 1984, which was The Search for Spock, and now 1986, which is Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. And then William Shatner actually hosted a Saturday Night Live where he said that Voyage Home in Japan was also known as the Sulor Master of Navigation. So, but Star Trek IV actually hit a really good, almost kind of like a social context point, which Star Trek usually does. And this was the one that everyone remembers about saving the whales, because the whole point of Star Trek IV was that Kirk and company go back in time to save a pair of humpback whales so that they can bring them forward into the future to answer an alien probe that was decimating Earth's oceans. It was a lot of fun. It had great humor. It had great, again, social context. It was directed by Leonard Nimoy. It was co-written by Nicholas Meyer of Star Trek II fame. And I think it probably gave a lot of people a really good entry point into Star Trek, because it wasn't the Star Trek that was really heavily based in the techno babble and the geek weight that Star Trek usually requires of an audience. It was a lot of fun. It had great heart. And for me personally, it created one of the greatest characters in Star Trek of all time, and that's Catherine Hicks as Dr. Gillian Taylor. So I loved her in that role.
My favorite part about that film was Spock kind of coming back into his own, and the relationship with McCoy in that whole thing. And that was McCoy's probably my favorite original series character. And that was one of the things I really enjoyed about that, was those two bumping off. Of course, having them come back into time and having this kind of caper to get what they need, and, you know, being able to fix the captured Klingon bird of prey with the special
transparent aluminum.
Yes, transparent aluminum to get Gracie and the whales in there. So yeah,
easily one of the most memorable scenes where Scotty the chief of engineering of Starfleet, you know, in the 23rd century, talking into essentially what was a Mac mouse. Yeah. He thought it was like a microphone. I mean, very
Hello
memorable.
Computer.
Very,
yeah.
Well, I got to say, I think the thing for this movie, because I remember this is probably. Was this at the time the most successful Star Trek film as far as total income in the box office?
At the time, it was the largest box office receipts, for sure.
The thing I remember about this film was talking to a lot of people who weren't necessarily Star Trek fans, but because this seemed, like you had said earlier, Norman, it was a great jumping in point, because you have like the techno babble, and I think it was a lighthearted film. You had a lot of comedy in this particular Star Trek film, and I remember just one appealing more to the general masses than any Star Trek film before, and I think even after it.
Yeah, because also you're dealing with a time travel movie, and you're dealing with a movie that has predominantly most of the scenes are in modern day, or at least 1986, Sausalito in San Francisco, so that's Northern California. So you don't have to worry about aliens and sets and all this kind of stuff. You're basically dealing with a lot of character development and the character issues. And like I said, without Catherine Hicks in there as Dr. Gillian Taylor, I think it would have lost a lot of its humanity. I love that scene where she's in there with Spock and Kirk, and she's like, you know, do you guys like Italian? And they start arguing about it. It's like, no, 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 yes, no. I love Italian. And so do you. Yes, you know, and Spock looking like he's an ex-hippie from Berkeley and high on the LDS.
So. Too much LDS.
That's right. LBS. Yeah. So it was a lot
where
of fun.
Are the nuclear vessels?
It was a great success for Star Trek for sure.
Now, the one thing I will point out, Star Trek Voyage Home was probably one of my favorite movies. And if I remember correctly, when they were on the streets of San Francisco, while they were filming it, each time someone would pass by, they would stop them and say, hey, you were being filmed. I need you to sign this waiver.
Especially in the nuclear vessel scene. Because yes, they wanted to have people just have their like natural reaction to what Walter Koenig and Nichelle Nichols were doing about the nuclear vessel station in Alameda. So they're like, what? I think it's across the bay in Alameda. You know, and it was funny. It was very fish out of water. And everyone loves fish out of water stories.
And briefly, and, you know, Norm, you wanted to talk about Hoosiers, right?
Oh, wow. Gosh, what's to say?
Hoosiers.
I mean, we can spend an entire show about this. Hoosiers,
we can't
to
do
me.
That.
I mean, I know. Hoosiers is like, it's the quintessential basketball film for me. It really is. I mean, you have Gene Hackman, first of all, who was amazing in this. Dennis Hopper, who also was amazing in this. And it's that movie. I think it was the movie for me that started the kind of trend of movies that you saw later on with, say, like Denzel Washington in Remember the Titans or
We Are Marshall.
Yeah. Or We Are Marshall, movies like that. Or even like Friday Night Lights. This was the movie that started the whole the renegade makes good, you know, because Gene Hackman was like a renegade coach. He comes into small town Indiana. His kind of big league coaching style, big city coaching style from like college. He came from the collegiate league.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden he got blackballed there because he was too volatile. Then now he started teaching like the high school level. And, you know, he was volatile there, but he cared so much. That was the point, is like no one was as passionate about basketball as Gene Hackman's character was. And then all of a sudden, you know, the boys started to respond to him. It's a great coming of age story for the boys. He was like learning a lot about himself. Barbara Hershey, I think, was coming off of either the success of Beaches, I think it was, with Bette Midler. So she had a really great role in that. It's just, it was so well done. It's just so much heart to it. Then Dennis Hopper being kind of like the alcoholic father who tried. You know, and at the end, it's like, you know, run the picket fence. So it was great. Great movie.
No, I got to throw in here real quick because I am a huge Hoosiers fan myself. And in my opinion, one of Gene Hackman's greatest performances. The thing I remember about Hoosiers, too, and when watching that film, and even to this day, is how well the movie depicts that small town country America at that time frame when Hoosiers was going on. You just felt like you were there in that town with those people. And I've got to say, too, you know, Norman, the greatness of the greatest basketball player ever, Jimmy Chitwood, and the fact he only actually had four lines throughout the entire film.
But it's David. It was the threat of Jimmy, you know, it was the threat of getting him back, you know.
Davis, did you see Hoosiers?
I did, but it was such a long time ago. I mean, like what Norm said, Remember the Titans, We Are Marshall, Hoosier. That was just one of those movies. It's a feel good movie. And that's what I remember to it. It's been a while since I've seen the movie, though.
Hey guys, guess what?
Hmm.
I've never seen Hoosiers.
It's timeless. The movie is timeless. It's because it's a period piece. And it's so well done. You can watch Hoosiers at the drop of a hat.
I love Gene Hackman too, but I never got around to seeing that.
I envy you because there are those moments where you get to see that movie for the first time or that show for the first time. I'm really stoked for you to see it for the first time because it's so good.
Made it sound so good. I want to see it now.
It is. And as much as I love Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, in this list of all these movies, well, with maybe the exception of Sid and Nancy because Gary Oldman's in it, I think Hoosiers is really like, it's like a cut above.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I'd have to agree with that.
Davis, what about you? What jumps out at you in November?
In November, well, Star Trek IV, of course. I mean, that was just a great movie all around together. You know, another movie, it's been a long time since I've seen it, but I remember it, was Firewalker.
Yes.
With two great Chuck Norris and Louis Gossett Jr. together. And it also had Sonny Latham, if I say his name right. Do y'all remember where he's from?
Oh, Predator, isn't that? He was in Predator too.
Yeah, he was the one of the guys in Predator.
Was he the Indian guy?
Yeah, he used to be a senator.
Wow.
He is absolutely insane.
John Rhys Davies is in there.
Well, he was also in 48 Hours.
Yeah.
So, I mean, those are the ones that actually just pop out at me. I mean, of course, I've seen American Tail, and that was a cute movie, but, you know.
That's Feifel, right?
Yeah,
Feifel.
Yeah.
Probably actually Don Bluth's most famous film.
I think so, yeah. What about you, Kyle? What jumps out at you in November?
Well, we've cut the big ones. Here's the great thing about November of 86. There were a few movies on this list that are classic cable movies. The kind of movies that would come on oddball times on cable networks, and you'd have to watch them because they were just so bizarre. And two of them that pop straight to mind are The Wraith with Charlie Sheen and the movie Solar Babies.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start with The Wraith. This is Charlie Sheen before a lot of people realized who Charlie Sheen was.
And Sherilyn Fenn.
Well, that was the next thing. Sherilyn Fenn looking absolutely gorgeous. The premise of this movie, for those of you who have not seen it, and I'm sure there's a lot of you out there, Charlie Sheen is basically, his character had died, and he's coming back as the Wraith. And he is racing, he died in a street race in the small town, they race up in the mountains or something like that. So he's taking out this gang of street racers who have been just raising havoc in this little town. And he has this...
So he comes back like the Crow to wreak havoc on these bad guys.
And he has this futuristic-looking car that was so amazing-looking at the time.
Oh, it's so good.
But, I mean, this was just one of those classic, you know, flip it on cable, you find it, and you'll see Charlie Sheen, and then you see Sherilyn Fenn, and then you're just glued to it, because you're like, what the heck is going on in this film? But the other one that I've got to talk about with that is the movie Solar Babies. Now, have any of you guys seen this film or remember this film?
I have not seen this film.
Only once.
Now, I have never seen it.
Now, to give you an idea, here's some of the people who are in this. Jamie Gertz. Mm-hmm. Jason Patrick.
What? There's a movie that I have not seen that has Jamie Gertz in it?
Jason Patrick. Lucas Haas. Peter DeLuise. Adrian Pasdar.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Now, Adrian Pasdar got a lot of work in the 80s.
Oh,
yeah, he did.
I don't think he's changed looks from the 80s, from how he looks now. now the craziness of this is that it's a post-apocalyptic Earth. Water is like run dry. And they play this weird like version of roller hockey. And it's about this group of like orphans who find this magical, mysterious orb called Bodai. And Bodai is supposed to bring rain back to the earth. Again, it's one of those so bad it's good movies.
Oh my God.
I gotta see it. It's got Jamie Gertz. I gotta see it.
But the only other one that I gotta throw out in November too is you gotta mention The Mosquito Coast.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
I mean,
Harrison Ford and right. River Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
And oh, I forgot Helen Mirren was the mom.
Yeah.
So hot.
Just saying. Jason Alexander of Seinfeld fame in it.
I'm sorry, an eccentric and dogmatic inventor sells his house and takes his family to Central America to build a utopia in the middle of the jungle. Then conflicts with his family and a local preacher. This was one of the few films that, spoiler alert, Harrison Ford actually dies in.
What?
It's true.
There's not a lot of films that he's in where he dies, with the exception of the most recent one.
I was going to say, wait a minute.
What? He dies? Yeah, what?
Spoiler alert, man. I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, Star Wars dead.
The most telegraphed death I have ever seen on any movie ever.
Good choices. I have to jump on one of my favorites. And what's interesting about this is I did not see this film in 86. I saw it on VHS when I was a young musician learning my trade, learning my craft, and learning my history. And I had a had this coworker of mine I was working with, and he was an older guy, and he was a musician as well. He taught me a lot. His name was I'm gonna remember his name. His name was Rich, and he was a good musician, and he was kind of my Obi-Wan to music. He was very knowledgeable, and he was opening me up to a lot of different musicians. And he says, "Oh, you like punk music, huh? Well, you might want to check out this movie called you like the Sex Pistols? Well, why don't you check out this movie called Sid and Nancy?" And I'd gotten the Sex Pistols, Never Mind the Bullocks album, but I had not seen this film. And I said, "Well, who's in it?" And he says, "Well, I think you might know him. He's been in a few films, and he's a very, very good actor." And he's kind of teasing me with it at work, and he's like, "Here, just take the VHS and go watch it. It's worth watching." And I said, "Okay, look at it. It's got Gary Oldman in it. Oh my God." And so I was like, okay, I got to check this out. And of course, a great music biop about the Sex Pistols, playing Johnny Rotten, and about what happened to him and his drug abuse, and eventually what led to the death of his girlfriend, and of course, himself and his overdose. Gary Oldman was fantastic in this film. This was the film that I really kind of started to realize how good an actor Gary Oldman was. And he was just like this chameleon that changed every role, and he's legendary now. If you're a fan of music in general, and of course the history of the Sex Pistols, playing Sid Vicious, he was absolutely fantastic. And he was basically brought into the band because of his attitude and the way he looked. He was a horrible musician, and he didn't really write the stuff that was there. They had another bass player before him. They fired that did most of that the writing for that band and the bass parts. But one of my favorite films of that month. Unfortunately, it took me quite a while to see that as well. But that was one of my favorites. Any other films here in November you guys want to touch on before we move to December? Nope. All right. Yep. Okay, here we go. In December, on December 5th, we had Heartbreak Ridge.
Yes.
Yeah. Gunny. December 12th, mm-hmm. we had Crimes of the Heart. We had The Golden Child,
yes.
Eddie Murphy's follow-up to Beverly Hills Cop.
I'm sorry, I want the knives. Yes.
Bring me the knives.
Perfect, perfect. Yeah. We had The Three Amigos.
Hoy!
December 19th, we had King Kong Lives, Little Shop of Horrors, No Mercy, and a feel-good movie called Platoon.
Some great Christmas movies for this time.
Yeah.
Yeah, right?
December 25th, we had a movie called The Morning After, and December 31st, we had Wisdom. Kyle, I want to start with you first. I have a feeling which you might be picking, but I want you to pick a movie that jumps out at you here.
There's two on the list. Of course, we all know about Platoon and Heartbreak Ridge. We're going to talk about those, but I got to start off.
Why don't we do this? Why don't we save those till the end? Let's touch on a couple of other ones first.
Yeah,
I know
absolutely.
We all talk about those.
I got to start with Eddie Murphy and The Golden Child.
Yeah.
I mean, he was coming off Beverly Hills Cop. He was at the height of his popularity. And I've always thought The Golden Child was one of his more fun and risky movies for him to do, because you didn't see Eddie Murphy doing a lot of movies like this. And this movie, I can turn this movie on now and just sit back and enjoy it. There was nothing about this movie that I hated. He's funny. Like we talked about, I'm here for the knife. I mean, it's just, there's everything that's, and I mean, and I can't think of the female leads in it, but she was gorgeous.
We had Charlotte Lewis.
Charlotte Lewis, yeah.
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 Who was gorgeous.
Victor Wong. Randall Tex Cobb.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And never go wrong James with Hong.
Wait, also in the great Charles Dance as the demon.
Zardo.
Yes.
Zardo,
yes.
Yeah. Noomspa.
Saddam Noomsi. Brother Noomsi.
Brother Noomsi.
Now, but there is one other that stands out for me And all I got to say is, I'm a mean green mother from outer space. And that is Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah.
I mean, I went to see this not quite knowing what to expect. And I had such a blast with this film. I mean, Rick Moranis at his absolute best. Steve Martin was great in this
film. I want to be a dentist.
And I've got to say, this is probably outside of like The Wizard of Oz, the first musical I'd actually ever seen in a theater.
I have to agree with you too, because I didn't know what to expect either. I didn't know it was a musical, but I absolutely enjoyed it. And you have to look at the rest of this cast here. Of course, Steve Martin, you had Jim Belushi, John Candy, Christopher Guest, Bill Murray. It was just this awesome cast, and it was hilarious.
And I mean, come on, when the movie opens up and they come out with the three women going, Little Shop of Horrors. I mean, you're just losing it right there from the start. And the work they did on the puppetry for Audrey 2 and what they made that plant look like was just so amazing.
I hope NBC does this, because they're doing all these great musicals. You know, they started off with Sound of Music with, you know,
Peter
Carrie
Pan.
Underwood. And then, yeah, they did Peter Pan. And then they just recently did Grease, and now they're doing Hairspray. I hope they do Little Shop of Horrors.
I
can't see where you wouldn't. But
yeah,
those are the two that really just stand out to me for having fun. Got to throw out the terrible King Kong Lives, though, because that I don't know what happened there.
By the way, Frank Oz directed Little Shop of Horrors.
Well, yes, he did.
Yes. Davis, what about you? Now, we're going to touch on Heartbreak Ridge and Platoon. Those are the big ones, all of us at the end here. But is there any of those other ones that jump out at you?
Well, I love The Golden Child, and I thought that was actually just a funny movie all around. And interesting note, they had the same budget as Star Trek IV.
$10 million?
$25.
That all went to Eddie Murphy.
But one of the cool things about it is, I don't remember if y'all know this, the soundtrack for Golden Child was done by John Barry.
Oh,
who actually did the soundtrack to The Black Hole.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So that's really cool. And, you know, I would be remiss without saying The Three Amigos was a funny movie.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, you can't go wrong with Steve Martin, Chevy Chase, and Martin Short as the lead. So
that's just a comedy classic right there. That was one of those films I didn't see till years later on VHS. Norm, what about you? Any of those jump out at you?
I actually do really actually enjoy The Golden Child a lot. I don't know. It's one of those things where, Eddie Murphy had this great run of successes with 48 Hours and another 48 Hours, maybe, and Beverly Hills Cop, and Beverly Hills Cop 2, and Trading Places. And I just think it was fun. And also there was, it's not an uncommon thing in Hollywood where you would pitch something and then something would kind of splinter off of that idea. You have Iron Eagle, you have Top Gun, you have The Golden Child, you have Big Trouble in Little China. There was an issue there where they felt that The Golden Child and Big Trouble in Little China were very, very similar in certain respects because of the supernatural quality of what was going on. But I really liked Eddie Murphy in this. Charlotte Lewis, it kind of like introduced us to her. She was incredibly beautiful, but it was fun because he played a character that was a little interesting and uncomfortable for him. But yes, we had some Big Trouble alumni in there. You had Victor Wong, who played Egg Shen, who was also Charlotte Lewis's father. And did you say that James Hong is in The Golden Child as well? Who was David Lopan?
Guy, jeez.
He spiritually possessed me at the beginning of the film. So those two, Victor Wong and James Hong, I mean, those guys are, they are trademark tentpole 80s Asian actors. Also, to finish off that triumvirate, you also had Al Leong, and we talked about him earlier.
Yeah.
So those three guys, you know, they always are in the Asian movies. I'm surprised he wasn't in this movie too, but it was fun because you had to deal with some really interesting supernatural things going with, like, you know, Tibet and Nepal. Doctor Strange is really hot right now, so that kind of like has that resurgence. And he's just, I loved Charles Dance in this movie. Charles Dance most recently famous for being Tywin Lannister in Game of Thrones. But he was fantastic as Sardaunt Numspa. I love the fact that because he was a demon, he could not speak the letter J, because J in Hebrew, he could not speak, so he had to say it as a Y. It was, you know, just funny stuff like that, but I really liked it.
I guess I'm in the minority here, guys, because I saw this movie when it came out in the theater, and I have not seen it since. I did not like this film.
Watch it again.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. As I get older, I've realized that I have to do that, and you know, I kind of rediscover them that way. But it wasn't as good as Beverly Hills Cop to me, and I thought he was kind of trying too hard. I don't know at the time.
But why compare them?
Yeah, no, I wanted something more like that, and I think the supernatural part is what actually threw me off, to be honest with you. I was not expecting that, and I didn't want it at the time. Mm-hmm. And so that just totally kind of, I'm like, what am I watching here? This is not an Eddie Murphy film. So, you know, of course I was obviously a lot more judgmental and narrow-minded back then. But, you know, that's one of those films I'll probably have to
also known as being in your 20s?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Or late teens?
Yeah, no, it was late teens, definitely. Yeah. You know, we all think we know everything back then anyway. So.
But by the way, though, so I mean, it was coming off of that great Eddie Murphy hit, you know, Party All the Time. So. Girl, I can't understand it. Why you want to hurt me? Oh, so good.
We are going to have to apologize to all the listeners for all the singing in this episode.
After all of the things I've done for you.
Karaoke night at the Fandom Podcast Network.
I can't help it. My blood bleeds Filipino. I can't
help it. Nice. All right, guys. We got to talk about the two big films here in December. And let's start with Heartbreak Ridge. I think this is probably... I got to say, probably my favorite Clint Eastwood movie. And this, you know, that is a recent admission, I think, because I've seen all of his greats. You know, Unforgiven, he's great, of course. But there's just something about this film. And it was also something I shared with my father. Mm-hmm. My father and I saw this movie together. We loved it. We talked about it all the time. Every time it repeats on... you know, on cable television with commercials, my dad always tells me when it's on. And my dad used to also be a amateur bodybuilder back in the day. And so when the Swede comes on, he's all, God, look at that guy. He should be an action hero, you know. For those that do not know, it is about a hard-nosed, hard-living Marine gunnery sergeant. He clashes with his superiors and his ex-wife as he takes command of a spoiled recon platoon with a bad attitude. There's two reasons why I really like this film, other than the obvious, which is Clint Eastwood and the great cast, Mario Van Peebles, so on and so forth. I'm a big history buff. And two things that I found fascinating about this movie was, one, it opened me up to what's known as the Forgotten War, the Korean War. And I after seeing this film, I started doing my history and looking at it, because I was a big World War II buff. My dad loved watching World War II films, so I got into that. I love American history in general. I love world history. But the Korean War, when I learned in school, barely touched on it. And so it was nice that it brought that to light, and I got a little more knowledge about that after this film. You know, I remember talking to my dad about it. I talked to some Korean vets later, you know, and talked to them about it. But the other thing, too, was the campaign that was going on in Grenada, because that was huge on the news at the time. And it was fascinating for them to actually have a movie that took place going into that brief conflict about what was going on down there. And I thought that was fascinating, too. They didn't try to, you know, do something else, but they went into that. Let me open it up to you, Davis. What does Heartbreak Ridge, what do you remember of it?
Actually, I don't remember ever watching it. So,
oh, God.
Oh, my heart. I'm reading the synopsis of the movie, and I'm going, I'm trying to remember, but I don't think I ever... The one Clint Eastwood military movie I remember watching was Kelly's Heroes, because I also watched that with my dad, too. So I just don't remember this movie.
All right, looks like we all got homework this episode. Norm, what about you? Give me some Heartbreak Ridge. What you got?
Heartbreak Ridge was really interesting because it was the first time that I really kind of fell in love with Clint Eastwood as a military man. Most of the time you fall in love with him as a cowboy. My favorite, personally, my favorite Clint Eastwood movie is The Outlaw Josie Wales. But this is a really close second because, first of all, it was well written, well directed, great characters. I loved Mario Van Peebles as the Ayatollah of rock and roll.
Stitch Jones.
He was also kind of like hot off the success of being Sonny Spoon. You had a great cast of characters. I loved the guy who he was kind of like Gunny Highway's friend. You know, they kept insulting each other when Gunny Highway got his new orders as in charge of this.
If I was half as ugly as you are, I would be on a poster for the prophylactic.
Yeah, and I loved how these guys were like they chewed the same dirt, you know, when they were on the 38th parallel, you know, back in Korea. Is that 38th parallel? Am I saying that right?
Yes.
Yep. Yeah. Yes.
So they were friends there. They were Marines and this is kind of neat though. We're talking about this kind of like right after, what was it? We had the Marine Corps birthday not too long ago. Mm-hmm. But they were long range reconnaissance patrol. And these guys were supposed to be the best of the best. And I love the whole thing. Like, you know, he had them out for exercises and they were all wearing different t-shirts. And then he's like, you know, you have to wear the same t-shirt. So the next time they came out after they got punished for that, they all wore the same t-shirts. And then he goes, same as me. And how are we supposed to do that? You're supposed to improvise, adapt, overcome. You know, there are all these really great kind of thresholds that everyone was passing. And then finally there was a scene where Stitch Jones, you know, he was smart enough to realize, you know, that his friend or the lady that was working with him at the bar, you know, she was doing all of his laundry. So he finally was able to break through and on his t-shirt rotation. And I don't know, everything about this movie just screams genuine. It was just well written. Clint Eastwood was great in it. You could saw he was kind of starting to accept his age a little bit because, you know, back in the 80s, you know, in the 70s, you know, he was doing great stuff, you know, with obviously all the Harry Callahan movies and Any Which Way But Loose and You Can. Those movies, Escape from Alcatraz, you know, and obviously all of his Westerns. But this was something that where you really saw him like accept being older.
Yeah.
And accept kind of like his physicality. And not that he was at all out of shape. I mean, he could whip any of us right now in a heartbeat. But I also really liked Everett McGill in this movie. I loved him in Dune when he was Stilgar. And then in this movie, he was the West Point. He was
the pencil pushing, what was it? The major that never saw any combat.
Yeah, he was like Gorman in Aliens. You know?
Exactly.
He was the guy that he was all training but no experience.
Exactly.
And I love the pit fight in the end. You know where the Swede was just like crushing people.
Yeah. Well, the one thing that we can agree, and Kyle, I want to touch with you on this, is that this is one of those films that we can quote so many awesome lines. And Kyle, I'm going to turn it to you. I know you got some that you're burning to tell. Tell me what Heartbreak Ridge means to you.
Well, I have to admit, it's been a few years since I've actually watched this, but I am in full agreement with Norman. I think Heartbreak Ridge was the film that really sold me on Clint Eastwood military films. And what I just remember this, seeing this when I saw this for the first time, because I watched it with my parents, just how powerful this film is. I mean, when you really see the bond that develops and the respect that happens between Clint Eastwood's character and this ragtag, disrespectful group of recons and how he brings them together and what happens in this film, it just always stood out to me. And I will say this is easily probably top three of Clint Eastwood performances of all time. And I think this movie, the sad part about this movie is I don't think it gained a lot of respect until later because of the other movie we have to talk about, which is Platoon, because I think Platoon so overshadowed this movie at the time. And I think this movie really found its respect a couple of years later in the VHS market.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's funny, too, because there's so many people that I know that remember this movie more fondly now than Platoon because of how heavy Platoon was. This one had obviously humor in it, but it was nice to, you know, one of the things that really jumps out at me was at the end of this film, where you get to see him bring these guys together, because, you know, in the beginning, his platoon, his recon platoon, did not want anything to do with him. And but he's able to, you know, get them together, get them to fight together as a unit. And then at the end, when they're kind of held up and they're kind of surrounded, they call in for air support. When Mario Van Peebles pulls out his credit card and
good.
Gets on the phone and calls in for air support, and like the operator girl's like, "Are you serious?" But it was one of those things that he learned, you know. You got to overcome, you got to adapt and stuff. So that was one of my favorite scenes. And there's so many wonderful quotes in this film.
Now,
well.
And how many times has that been used now in other films? Using the credit card to call in.
Yes. Oh, yeah. It's just, and of course, one of the most famous is, "Sir, that's the AK-47 assault rifle, the preferred weapon of your enemy, and it makes a distinctive sound when fired at us, sir."
Why? Why, yes, it does.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's good. When it comes, you know, Clint Eastwood is very quotable when he does speak, and most of his Westerns, he barely speaks. But in this film, he just got so many rich lines. And it was just, the script is just fantastic. So
I think the neat thing also in this film is that you saw that huge kind of like distinction between the heroes of the old wars versus kind of like now. I'm not saying that every single like Marine reconnaissance platoon was like that, but you saw this whole, this is what the military was when Gunny Highway was in, you know, in his prime service, and this is what it's become. And he really wants to kind of reestablish that, okay, guys, we are Marines. We have a high tradition, a very rich history that we need to still uphold. And you guys aren't doing that. I want to let you know about our heritage and the honor that we have to serve with. And I think that at the end, they kind of understood that, his platoon understood that with Stitch Jones or Mario Van Peebles kind of like leading that way.
Yeah. Now we must get on to the movie that pretty much was an emotional gut punch for everyone. And that is Platoon, starring Tom Berenger, Willem Dafoe, and a huge supporting cast. We have Kevin Dillon, John C. McGinley, Johnny Depp. It just goes on and on. Of course, directed by Oliver Stone, about a young recruit played by Charlie Sheen in the Vietnam Forces, faces a moral crisis when confronted with the horrors of war and the duality of man. I'll lead us in on this. I just want to say that I did see this with my dad, and we really saw the horrors of war in this film, I think, more than I remember anything else. You know, when it came to violence, the movie that really kind of scarred me with violence, like straight up, you know, in your face violence, was RoboCop. But this was like real hardcore, you know, emotional violence as well. And there was a lot of scenes that still bother me when I watch this. It wasn't soon after, you know, it's like 10 years after the end of the Vietnam War. And it showed just how horrible things were, but how horrible just, you know, at times the Americans were as well. But Norm, I want you to start on this one here. Do you remember seeing it in the theater when it first came out like I did?
I did see it in the theater, and for nefarious reasons, to be completely honest. I was in New York City with a friend of mine, and he said that this is one of the theaters in the city that allowed you to smoke, because I was a smoker at the time, and not a hardcore smoker, but I was in high school. So you could sneak a cigarette and actually watch a movie and smoke, right? So,
wow.
Right, and which is kind of funny, because he had a smoking section in the theater and, you know, non-smoking section, but there was no walls or air humidifiers or anything like that, so the smoke was pretty much everywhere. But that's beside the point. I think the thing that really made the biggest impact on me about this film, more so later on than when I first saw it, was that usually the depictions of soldiers in war movies were heroic and very, very pointed. Soldiers were heroes. And in this particular movie, the soldiers were questionable. Their motives were questionable. And Vietnam, the characters that I knew about the Vietnam War up until this point were characters like John J. Rambo, you know, in First Blood and in Rambo Part 2, or First Blood Part 2. You know, he was like the super soldier, superhero type of soldier. But now you have to deal with Charlie Sheen's Chris. You have to deal with Elias. You have to deal with Tom Berenger, who was
Sergeant Barnes.
Barnes. You had so many different characters, so many different people. They were just real. They were just guys. You know, they were drafted in there. Obviously, I knew Apocalypse Now before I walked into this movie, but even Apocalypse Now was like even a grander tale. I think what Platoon did, and this is what Oliver Stone was very famous for, is that Platoon gave you the sense that you are in the same boots as these guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
You were walking in the muck. You were getting bitten by ants. You were terrified beyond belief in the darkest depths of the jungle, and you just wanted to get out. And I think that there are situations where you saw that they were doing some questionable things, especially Sergeant Barnes, and there was a very moral grayness to it, this entire movie. So when you walk out of the movie at the end, you don't feel uplifted in a way where, say, you know, Rambo saves the day or the soldier saves the day. You're just like, damn, I can't believe these guys actually went through that. And it gets you into a very real mental state where you're like, that doesn't seem right.
Right.
You know,
right.
That whole situation just didn't seem right. And I think that was truer to what Vietnam was than, say, like these superhero type soldiers.
Right. Kyle, what about you? What did Platoon, how did it hit you?
Well, to be honest with you, I didn't see Platoon for about 6 months after it hit the theaters. I kind of had to sneak it in. My parents went and saw this movie and refused to let me see it. They were so impacted by that. And I ended up going with a friend and his dad. It kind of, you know, but here's the thing I think about Platoon when I think about it for our generation, because of our age in that, when this particular film came out, I think this was really the first movie that had an emotional impact in a way that made you stop. And when you walked out of the theater, really made you stop and think about what you had just seen.
Right. Yeah.
You know, we had our Star Wars, we had our Empire Strikes Back, we had our fun movies, but I think for our generation at the age we're talking about, this was the movie that we came out and went, I just really saw the real world on a film screen. Something
right.
we weren't alive or so young for, we truly couldn't understand. And seeing that and talking to a lot of people after that film, they said, you have to take that movie and you have to even multiply it by more to truly understand what was going on over there. But at the time, this was a great true denominator of what people experienced who went over there.
Right.
And I mean, I just look at the cast. I mean, you like you said, Berenger, Keith David was in this film, Forrest Whitaker. I mean, this goes down in my book as probably one of the more emotional and powerful movies of my lifetime.
Right. Davis, what about you?
So this was at a time when my grandfather, who was in World War II, was telling me many of his stories, and I loved hearing all about the stories that he shared with me during World War II. So when seeing this movie, it was very intense. I did not see it till many, many, many years later. And it was like what Norm and Kyle had said. I mean, it was one of those movies where you had to really stop and think and go, who was actually really the heroes in this movie?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, and I think also, if I remember correctly, wasn't William Dafoe and Tom Berenger's characters, weren't they purposely switched? Because
yes.
Tom Berenger was like a good guy all the time.
Yes.
And William Dafoe was a bad guy, so they switched the two?
Well, they were both cast as each other's characters, and then it got switched, I think. That's what the deal was, you know. And both of those roles were just fantastic. And, you know, the iconic scene of Willem Dafoe's character holding his arms up as he's, you know, getting shot from behind him, but you know, a million times. There's a couple of scenes in this film though that I want to say that resonate me that I will never ever forget. One of them is, because it scared the crap out of me because the tension was so there, is when the platoon was sleeping in the rain and Charlie Sheen's character was not the one that was supposed to be awake. Someone else was supposed to be awake and on the M60 and waiting to see if they were going to be ambushed. Then all of a sudden he wakes up because he hears something and he realizes that the guy that should be awake is sleeping.
Well, he was getting bitten by ants.
Is that what it was? Was that,
yeah, he was okay. Getting bitten by, he couldn't sleep because he was getting bitten by ants.
That's right. And then he sees something in the background and he sees a helmet and he realizes the enemy's there. And then,
yeah.
And then, you know, he opens up and everyone starts, you know, and then all hell breaks loose. The other thing, there's two other scenes too. The one where it was the end battle scene where I forget which character that it was. I think it was John C. McGinley's character where he protects himself by pulling on his dead buddy's corpse over him inside the pit.
Yep.
I'd never seen that before, and that was scarring. And on a personal level, and I'm going to get real personal here, guys, I have a brother who's autistic. And there's a scene in the film where they are basically making fun of a villager with special needs. And I refuse to watch that scene if this movie's ever on. I cannot get over that scene. That scene just scarred me, and I know it bothered my father as well. But that was the thing about that film, though, was that it was a gut punch to war. It was not glorified, and as you said, Norm, the Americans, it was gray. They didn't come across as the heroes. You know, you saw the worst side of the U.S. soldiers and what they were going through, and, you know, whether they had personal demons or personal agendas or whatever, you really got a glimpse in how horrible war is. And that, you know, we're used to seeing the Americans be the good guys and, you know, working together all the time. And it was one of those films walking out of there. I was just like, oh my God, what did I see? And, you know, I remember getting it on VHS and watching it again and again, because to me, it was one of those things where I wanted to kind of – I didn't want to forget what I saw, but the acting was just fantastic in that film.
Now, you know? Quick question for you guys as far as this goes. Is this still Oliver Stone's best film?
Not for me.
Not for me, no.
No, but it's just because it's hard for me to relate to the subject matter. And I know that for those people that served in Vietnam, I remember at the time there were so many reports saying, like, this guy understood, like, he was, well, Oliver Stone was in Vietnam. You know, he served. Mm. So I know a lot of vets were crying out. They're like, this is real. This is how it was. This is the closest thing to Vietnam that's been on screen up until this point.
My favorite film by Oliver Stone was Natural Born Killers. That's my favorite one.
Mine's Wall Street.
Yeah. What about you, Kyle?
I'm going to have to go with Wall Street or JFK.
Also good. How about Davis?
You got any Oliver Stone pick movies you like?
It would have to be either Wall Street or Any Given Sunday.
That's another good one. Yeah.
That was a good one. I love that one.
Well, unless you guys got something else you want to touch on in December, I'm going to move on to the awards ceremony.
Well, I have to say that in probably for anything, like Platoon probably gave us one of the most indelible moments in cinematic history, and that was the death of Sergeant Elias.
Yeah.
The whole way that it was filmed, it was set to Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings, the way that it's rare that a pose strikes such a resonant chord. It's burned into your memory the way he's like just kind of looking up. It's almost that whole like, why have you forsaken me, God, kind of things, you know?
Yeah.
Like you can't divorce yourself from that scene and not knowing that it's Platoon.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's get on to the Academy Award winners of 1986. The best movie was Platoon. The best director was Oliver Stone of Platoon. Best actor was Paul Newman, Color of Money. Best actress, Marlee Matlin, Children of a Lesser God. Best Supporting Actor was actor Michael Caine for Hannah and Her Sisters. And also for Hannah and Her Sisters, Best Supporting Actress went to Diane Wiest. Did any of those really kind of surprise you? Platoon was just huge with the Academy Awards. What about you, Davis? What did you think about the awards there? You know, were these all deserved? Because I thought so. You know, Paul Newman got his finally, you know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. When you look at just that list right there, it's all well deserving for sure.
Yeah. Norman, you got anything about the awards? Anything jumps out at you there?
I think it was surprising that neither Willem Dafoe or Tom Berenger won for Platoon. And I know that they were both nominated for their roles.
Yeah.
What about you, Kyle? Any of these Academy Awards jump out?
Well, I got to go with, again, Paul Newman. It was, he won it because it was the Academy realized we need to recognize Paul Newman and this might be our last chance to do it. But again, how, you know, it could have easily went to either Willem Dafoe or Tom Berenger without question. I don't think anybody would have been upset, but it was the Academy finally recognizing Paul Newman there. Everything else I think was pretty much a hands down.
Right. Fun fact, if it weren't for the collaboration between Paul Newman and Tom Cruise in this film, and then Paul Newman introducing Tom Cruise to the world of race car driving,
we wouldn't have
gotten Days of Thunder.
That's right. Now, to lighten things up real quick regarding Platoon, there is one other thing that I always think of when I think of Platoon, and that is the dating montage scene in Naked Gun with Priscilla Presley and Leslie Nielsen, and they're going around having fun and they're walking out of Platoon laughing.
Sorry, Lord have mercy.
Throw that out there. Okay, now the other prestigious awards that we must talk about is the 1986 Golden Razzie Awards.
Wow.
For Worst Picture and Worst Screenplay, we had Howard the Duck. But Worst Picture also shared Under the Cherry Moon. There was a tie. Norm, I think Norman's shaking his head right now.
They got that all wrong.
Worst Director was Prince for Under the Cherry Moon. I didn't realize he directed that film.
Yeah.
Worst Actor was Prince Under the Cherry Moon. Worst Actress was Madonna for Shanghai Surprise.
Not a good year for musical actors. No.
Worst Supporting Actor was Jerome Benton for Under the Cherry Moon. Worst Supporting Actress was Dom DeLuise in drag for Haunted Honeymoon. Norm, I want you to touch on, you didn't really get a chance to really talk about Howard the Duck in our last show. And I know this has now become a cult favorite. A lot of people really like this film. Of course, there was reference to Howard the Duck at the stinger scene in Guardians of the Galaxy. Norm, give us something quick here on Howard the Duck. I know you love this film.
I think it's fun. It's a fun film and basically the hottest scene of Lea Thompson ever committed to film, maybe with All the Right Moves as a close second. But she was, that lingerie scene was pretty hot, but it was fun. It's a goofy film. I think that if people like think this is a terrible film, I think you've lost your sense of humor.
Yeah. Yeah. It's become a cult classic now. It's one of those films that I think got panned by a lot of people, but I think they've come back to rediscover it and like it. Cause when I first saw it, I didn't like it, but then I rediscovered it again on video and now I like it. Actually, I think it's very funny. And Lea Thompson's just so hot in there. I love the girl, whole girl punk band thing going on. And she kind of looks like a cross between Cyndi Lauper and someone from the Bengals. And
don't forget Academy Award winning actors come out of this movie. Like, Academy Award nominated Jeffrey Jones, Academy Award winning Tim Robbins were nominated. Tim Robbins was in it.
That's right.
You know, there and also I wish that they used the actual Howard the Duck the way that he looked in this movie in Guardians instead of like closer to the Marvel version of Howard the Duck.
That would have been epic right there.
I do think we have to thank the Marvel Cinematic Universe for actually bringing Howard the Duck popularity back up. So
I wish he owned an Infinity Stone. Howard the Duck deserves an Infinity Stone.
Well, before I introduce a segment with Alan R. Ryan, I did want to mention the top 10 1986 box office films are number 10, Ferris Bueller's Day Off with 70 million plus. Number 9, Ruthless People with 71 million. Number 8, The Golden Child with 79 million. Number 7 was Aliens with 86 million. Back to School was at number 6 with 91 million. Star Trek The Voyage Home was at number 5 with 109 million. Number 4 was The Karate Kid Part 2 with 115 million. Number 3 was Platoon with 138 million. Number 2 was Crocodile Dundee at 174 million. And with just $2 million more, was number 1 was Top Gun at $176 million. And like I said, Kyle, I think you had mentioned, Kyle, those movies were playing like well into the next year and just kept going and going.
Yeah, so. I think that's the thing that made 86 so special was there were so many movies in 86 that just had these incredibly long run times in the theaters. I mean, we've been kind of hinting about 1987. None of those movies in 87 had the kind of runtime that these 86 films had.
Yeah, and it was one of those things, too, where I think that a lot of films wanted to make the jump to VHS or home video sooner so they can make that money on that as well when that started really steamrolling. Now, before we move on and end things here, I just want to go ahead. I want to introduce I got together with Alan R. Ryan, our friend down there in Australia. Of Oz Fans Radio, a dear friend of mine, and I wanted to get his take on the year of 1986, and here is that interview now. Welcome, Fandom Podcast Network listeners, here for the Fandom Flashback 1986, the movies, 30 years later, part 4, where we will cover October, November, and December. But I have a very special guest today. We wanted to squeeze him in on this special four-part series, and he's a very near dear friend of mine. An apprentice, so to speak, when it comes to the podcasting universe. I'd like to welcome Alan R. Ryan of the Gold Coast of Australia and host of Oz Fans Radio. How are you, my friend?
I'm good and great to be here. The master to the Padawan apprentice, that is, of course, Kevin the Raider Nerd Geek Raider Reitzel. That's right. The man himself, who was started on Gold Coast Radio Network live here in Queensland at Quinlan's Cantina Part 1 before Part 2 came in this lovely new house here. And I'm doing well, mate. How are you?
I'm doing good. Now, you know, we've been having trouble getting you on because of our schedules and time difference, so I wanted to make sure that we got you in on the final part of this four-part series, which has been a great fun here, traveling back to 1986. And we had to get you on to get your take on the year of 86 because it was a huge movie. And we're kind of making an argument. Is this the best year of movies? So I want to dive right in with you and kind of get an idea of where you're at with 1986. Now, when it comes to the biggest movies, we have obviously the blockbusters out there. We've got Top Gun. We've got Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Crocodile Dundee. A lot of these big movies with big movie receipts. Before we move into the part 4, which we're going to cover today, which is October, November, December, of the first three quarters of the year, is there any of these movies that pop out at you, that you really, really like? Even if it's not part of the top 10 box office receipts, pick a couple of movies. Let me know what's important to you.
Well, let's go from the top. One movie I think that all of you internationally need to know a little bit more about, and there's a young girl out here in Australia that knows exactly what I'm talking about, that is Crocodile Bloody Dundee, mate, how you going?
That was a huge hit over here in the States, and it made a lot of tourism come over, and of course it kind of maybe typecast a certain someone, but how was it for you guys, for you there in Australia?
Huge out here in Australia, and the biggest box office it did was actually in drive-in theaters, which were huge through the 80s out here, where you took your ute down and you parked in there, you put your speaker on the window, and you had a cold beer. Who can have a cold beer in a drive-in? Australians can, mate. And they make sure they've got nice big Doritos or Smith's chips, and they watch the bloody movie, don't they? That's right. We loved it out here because it really was quintessential Australia gone international. And, of course, this really led to a lot of other things like Young Einstein and Reckless Kelly and other things that fed off the success of Paul Hogan, who's just basically a TV guy. That's where he started. And, of course, you know, Linda Kozlowski, you know, came in and, hey, how you doing? I'm from the United States of America. You know, and she went in there and she basically injected that into Australia. And that's the twist. That's what's so good about bringing that aboard was that you could take something like that and bring it international. But I think it really did well for us out here because, I mean, we had the sayings, you know, that's not a knife, this is a bloody knife, you know, and all that sort of classics. Well, that, look, that, it was great.
What's funny, when Erin was talking about that on the last episode, she was saying that there was two versions of the film, that there was an Australian cut one that they had to cut a lot of the Australian slang out of that version for the United States. And if that were to happen between you and us right now, our interview would only be about 2 minutes, right?
It would be. Yeah. Here's Kevin the Raider News, a lesson for today. When you want to use a slang word to describe a tough day, you go, oh, struth. Take truth and put S on the front. Struth.
Ah, struth.
There you go. You're sounding Scottish there. I don't know why, but they sound Scottish.
I'm sorry. That happens when I talk to you. Other than Crocodile Dundee, of some of the other films that came in the first three quarters, was there any of them that also come to you as something
huge? Absolutely massive. We've got Platoon. We've got Aliens. Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. Probably the greatest Star Trek film ever made. Sorry, JJ.
Well, hold on. Before we go to that's part of the one that I'm going to ask you about in a minute. But I'm talking about the first three quarters. You know, before we get into October, November, December, we're going to get into Platoon and Star Trek in this one. But you know, I'm talking about like Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and you know, there's also one of my favorites, Band of the Hand, Crocodile, Raw Deal, Cobra,
The Hitcher.
What's that?
That was a great film.
Which one?
The Golden Child.
Ah, yes, that's another one that's in the last
quarter. Golden Child. I want the knife.
Well, that is
imagine
that,
Paul Hogan.
Oh yeah, totally. That, you know, that, I think that was following up on. Was that Beverly Hills Cop 2 that came after Golden Child? Because I know that he did obviously his last huge hit made a huge. Huge presence on the original Beverly Hills Cop. And this, I think, was his follow-up. And this came out in December, and it was a huge moneymaker. It was in the top 10, and it came out in December. Did you like that film a lot?
I love that film. Look, there's a number of ones that stick out for me. There's one that George doesn't like too much, which is Coward the Duck.
Yes. Yeah, no, a lot of people
love that. But I actually love that. That's quintessential for me. I love it.
Howard the Duck. I know Norm's a big fan of that. It's funny. I didn't like it when it first came out in the theater. I wasn't sure what to expect. There were certain aspects to it that I liked, and had Leah Thompson in it. I thought she was cute, and you know, she was in this kind of hard rock punk band. But I panned it for a long time, and still I kind of rediscovered it on video later on and enjoyed it for what it is. And you know, being kind of like the first official Marvel film, and then of course making the secret stinger at the end of Guardians was great too. So yeah,
there's some great films that came out, and I think are kind of forgotten. And some like Manhunter, which came out, and that was such a brilliant film. Yeah. And the thing is that was made in such a way that it was a thriller that you had no sense of what was going to happen next. And I love the fact that it was something that, I mean, Silence of the Lambs stole everything from it. I mean, in that direction of where things went. And I love that version of Hannibal. But, I mean, there's comedies like Short Circuit. I mean, Short Circuit was fantastic.
Yeah, it was, and it was such a feel-good film, and the way that they can get the emotion from a practical prop puppet like Johnny Five, and it was kind of reminiscent of Empire Strikes Back, of how you can get the emotion from a puppet like Yoda. So, and of course, it had Ali Sheedy in it, and Steve Guttenberg was at the top of his game. Was that big in Australia?
That was huge. Not as big as another film, which was the sequel to Karate Kid, where we got Sato. Yeah. Miyagi, the dragon.
was that a huge hit over there in Australia?
Massive, absolutely massive. Not only was it massive in cinemas, because we all got to see that. I mean, I was probably in year five at the time in primary school, but we all took excursions to the cinema just to see what happened to, the man himself. By the way, it's actually the Karate Kid's birthday today as we speak.
Karate Kid 2 or Karate, what do you mean, like Daniel LaRusso's birthday?
Daniel LaRusso himself. Ralph Macchio. Ralph, mate, how you doing? It's a very good to see you, mate.
Well, let me ask you real quick. Let's touch on Top Gun real quick. What kind of impact did that have over there?
It was huge. Now, Top Gun's an interesting story for Australia, and it comes down to distribution. We got it quite late. Now, quite late indeed. I think it was about November or December that year. The reason was because, again, back in the 80s, everything was like, oh, Australia's too far away. We'll just send the film reels. Maybe they'll get there in 6 months. And that's what was basically like. Yeah. But when we did receive it, it was huge because the movie itself was in cinemas for 2 years. A lot of people don't know that. It was actually in the cinemas till 1988. And when we had the World Expo in Brisbane, so obviously that's a huge place that they basically pick an area in a city and just chock fill it. Well, Top Gun was everywhere. Merchandise, right. The F-14s, you know. Everyone was going around looking like Maverick, you know, like it was a big boy. And they're like, hey, look, it's Tom Cruise, hey. You know,
was everyone wearing the aviator glasses and the flight jacket?
Yeah, funny. I mean, it was absolutely spitting on summer, which was about probably 110 degrees Fahrenheit or maybe more, might even be 130. I mean, boiling. And people still right. wearing the bomber jacket.
Well, let me ask you something, being my brother from another country down there in Australia. There's a film that came out in 86 that a lot of fans really liked, but I think they found out about it on VHS home video like I did. But it starred one of your fellow Aussies, and that's Brian Brown starring in FX. What was your take on that film? And was that film at all popular down there?
It was, but the funny thing about that is, and Brian Dennehy obviously was stole most of the scenes, yes. And, you know, Brian is obviously a big part of it too. And I believe Greta Scacchi was in that. And Greta is still looking yum to this day. She
is beautiful, yeah.
Oh, she really is. Now, what's key about that is that that film itself, I think, got a very limited release out here and went to Betamax and VHS at the time. But when it went on Channel 10, so the Network 10 out here, which is one of our big free-to-air channels out here, that's when it really took off. So it's funny, it went really well internationally, I think mainly due to the fact that Brian Dennehy was in it, because it was quite a popular film even in the UK.
Right. Well, let me ask you this then. Before we move on to the final 3 months, we have to talk aliens. That was a huge huge subject that we covered in part three and is near and dear to everyone's hearts. Tell me about how aliens affected you. Did you see it when it first came out in the theater?
I actually didn't know. I knew, I was aware of how like good it was from people's reputations of going to the cinema and seeing it. So the film itself had a really good name about three mates of mine. I think at that stage I wasn't really getting into sci-fi film of that type. I was still very big into Star Wars, but it wasn't until this is what's funny about it. About 2 years after it came out, in about 88 or 89, I was watching TV and I was watching Enter the Dragon. They had it on one channel. And I kept flicking between the ad breaks to this other thing. I saw this really blue sort of vintage, pre-CGI, obviously, ship going across a planet. That ended up being the Sulaco. And when I saw it, I went, oh, it looks like a cold version of Star Wars. And then I had no idea it had aliens in it. Even though down the bottom at the bottom, it said rated M aliens when right, it came right. up from the ad. And then I eventually just stopped watching Enter the Dragon altogether and watched it from about halfway through when they get on the actual planet itself, LV-426, and I was hooked ever since. So I saw it 2 years after it came out, and it is probably the strongest film of 86.
Let me ask you this then. We had a little fun on the last episode. I want you to get – now, other than Ellen Ripley herself, played by Sigourney Weaver, I want you to give me your favorite character and your favorite quote of the film. Doesn't have to be from the character, but I want your favorite character from Aliens and your favorite quote from the film.
It's hard because I love all of them.
I know. It's a tough one, man.
Tough. I mean, everyone would say Hudson straight away.
That was my favorite.
You know, and the thing is, I love him, but he's the dividing one. I love him, but I love Hicks as well.
Yeah.
The only problem I have is, and it's something Macca has brought up, obviously, before when we've been on, is that Hicks should have died, and Hudson should have picked up the mantle as a cowardly lion and become the hero.
Well, he went out a hero's death for sure. Come on, come get some. Come get some. Come on. You want some of this?
So I will pick a quote for Hudson because I think it is the character for me. Maybe it's like an ant hive, man. Bees, man. Bees have hives. No, you know what I mean.
That's awesome, man. Well done. Well, let's move to the latter half of this part four. We're covering the movies of October, November, and December of 86. And I'm going to list off October real quick here for you. And if you could pop in on one or two of those that kind of stand out for you, if they do. We had Children of a Lesser God, tough guys. And that was October 3rd. October 10th, we had Jumpin' Jack Flash. Peggy Sue Got Married.
Let's go back to Tough Guys for a sec.
Tough Guys? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, Tough Guys obviously got Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas, the man with the chin. The dude with the pointed chin. He's a top bloke. I actually quite like the fact that he thought he was going to be John Rambo. That was quite funny.
Right.
But no, that film of them coming out of it always starts off like Hudson Hawk a little bit. You know, they're coming out of prison, but they're old timers, you know. And I love the fact that they have – it's a little bit like Captain America. They're out of sequence, out of time, and they've got to get with that time. And I just always thought that was a very – I mean, it's a cheap film, but it's got a good heart.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because this was kind of the last hurrah film for these actors before, you know, before Burt Lancaster eventually passed away and Kirk Douglas had some health issues and stuff. So I'm glad you brought that up because these guys are legendary actors in their time and they did so many good movies. So I'm really glad you brought that up. We also had we had Jumpin' Jack Flash, Peggy Sue Got Married, True Stories, Deadly Friend, The Color of Money, Trick or Treat.
That's a classic.
Soul Man and Let's Get Harry. Any of those jump out at you?
The Color of Money.
Yeah, why that one?
Why? Because it's good to see Paul Newman tell Tom Cruise where to go.
You mean put him in his place?
Yeah, well, Tom's a very tall man, of course. You know, standing on that phone book he does in every movie. You know, like a very tall.
You mean the lifts that he always wears and the little box he stands on?
I think he borrows the same ones from Robert Downey Jr., but, you know, like they tend to I do enjoy Tom's films to a certain extent, particularly his Jack Reacher stuff's been something a little bit different for him. And, look, he's no John Wick, but it's actually, there you go. There's a film, John Wick versus Jack Reacher.
Tom. Oh, we'll have to discover. We'll have to rediscover that later, but I like that.
It's the interplay.
This was an Academy Award winner for Paul Newman in this one.
Yeah, I mean, it's bringing back a character he played previously and sort of, I suppose, you know, taking the little apprentice smartass and really putting him in his place, but also teaching him.
Yeah, it was the Hustler that he originally did, and so you're revisiting this character in. At the time, you know, Tom Cruise was at the top of everything here, of course. You know, Top Gun is still playing in the theaters while this movie comes out. So this got, obviously, the Tom Cruise, got the younger crew to come in. And, of course, you had the legendary Paul Newman. And it's directed by Martin Scorsese, too.
That's right. I mean, you know, you got a busy year. And while this is all happening, a certain Scotsman is going to Chicago to film a big film that came out next year, actually. And, of course, he's very untouchable while he's in Chicago.
That's right. A future Oscar winner. That's right.
He's just got a tail of bullets.
Let's move into November here. We've got 52 Pickup, Modern Girls, Sid and Nancy, Something Wild, Quiet Cool, Hoosiers, Street of Gold, American Tail, Firewalker, The Wraith, Mosquito Coast.
Whoa.
Solar That's Babies. Hold on. Solar Babies, Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, and Eye of the Tiger.
Right. So we're going to go back by fives to a classic that you guys all need to see. You want to see Chuck Norris play a wimp.
Yeah. Are you talking about Firewalker?
We are talking about, and believe it or not, Alan R. Ryan has in his hot little hands right here in the collection, Firewalker the Blu-ray. Who the hell pays $20 for Firewalker the Blu-ray? Alan R. Ryan does.
Alan R. Ryan does. Okay, so let's talk briefly about that. We've got Lou Gossett Jr., who earlier in the year was in a modest hit called Iron Eagle, and Chuck Norris. It's a pair of adventurers who try down to track down an ancient Aztec Mayan Egyptian Apache hoard of gold. That's a lot of gold to drop down. Okay, Alan, tell us why Firewalker is near and dear to your heart, because that's a really good pick.
Firewalker is Indiana Jones with Walker, Texas Ranger, but a wimp, an absolute coward of a guy that doesn't know how to fight, doesn't know how to kick. It's not the classic Chuck. Best thing is, you've got an absolute ass kicker called Louis Gossett Jr. there to show him his ways.
Yes. What a good actor, too. You know, from being in one of my favorite films earlier, which of course we had mentioned, Iron Eagle, and of course one of our favorites, and we did an audio commentary of The Punisher with Dolph Lundgren.
And star also of the classic Toy Soldiers.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, that's right. With a young Will Wheaton and Sean Astin. Yeah, that's right. A good pick.
Frodo Baggins, sir. How you doing, sir?
Any of these other films in November? You know, like the Mosquito Coast. How about Star Trek? I know you're a big fan of Star Trek: The Voyage Home.
Star Trek was great, but I mean, I think we're missing probably one of the greatest performances of the career of Harrison Ford. Mosquito Coast, actually a personal favorite of mine. I saw that in the cinemas when it was released for the one day it was released in Australia, because it only released on one day.
One day only?
Considering the director's Australian.
Wow.
Isn't that bloody shit? Peter Weir.
I had no idea. The director is Peter Weir. Okay, so you get a one day, you get a director from Australia with this big American film and it's only released one day?
Aren't they nuts?
So what did you think of the film?
It wasn't even a big hit on VHS, but I love it because, again, it's a frustrated creative father who basically wants to go on his trip of destiny. And unfortunately, it takes his entire family with him, one of them being the future young Indy.
That's right. Yeah, River Phoenix, correct?
Yeah, that's the one. Anyway, he's got a brother called Lake.
That's right. And I forgot that Helen Mirren was in that as well. Yeah. By the way, I got that Lake. Got it.
Yeah, you got that Lake.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one. But I got distracted by Helen Mirren because she's come on and done, you know, made a huge impact in her acting career late in her career. She's flying high. So, well, I remember putting a trivia thing out there on Facebook a while ago about the Harrison Ford films, trying to name the Harrison Ford films that he actually dies in. Someone had brought up this movie and I had forgotten because I hadn't seen it in so many years. But is he seen dying in this film?
Yes, he is. He dies in the movie itself.
Okay, that's right. Yeah. So there's not many Harrison Ford films where you see him dying until just recently.
Oh, stupid. Spoiler, people.
I didn't say which movie. What about Star Trek? Star Trek Voyage Home.
Voyage Home's classic. I mean, everything. It was highly publicized when it was being filmed. And then when it was released, it was one of those films that, you know, you got right into. I think it's a film that had a really, a generous family feel from start, you know, and just to get away from all the it's not the darkness, but there was a certain dark tone to the last two.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, let me touch on December real quick before we wrap this up here. We've had December 5th, we had Heartbreak Ridge, we had Crimes of the Heart, Golden Child on December 12th, Three Amigos, King Kong Lives, Little Shop of Horrors, No Mercy, Platoon, and on December 25th, we had The Morning After, and on December 31st, we had Wisdom. Which one of these jump out at you, man? There's some Oscar contenders here as well.
What high school did you go to? I went to Heartbreak Ridge. I ain't heard of a school called Heartbreak Ridge, man. Get him the sweet! Get him the sweet! Sweet! Sweet!
Sweet! Sweet! And Mario Van Peebles, also in that film with... of course, we're talking about Heartbreak Ridge with Clint Eastwood. I had mentioned that as a tease in the last episode, this was one of my favorite Clint Eastwood films. What's your take on Heartbreak Ridge?
Oh, it is. It is. It's classic. You know, the fact that he's basically being jailed at the start. He's put in prison for urinating on a police officer's car. You know? What are you doing? Because it felt like the right thing to do at the time.
Yes, that was it was a great character study on someone like this who in some ways a character that is maybe kind of put out to dry, but he wants to come back and people need him to kind of get together this group of military men that are kind of slacking and they're not the men that he's used to fighting with, and able to turn this band of misfits into a band of brothers before they go down into the conflict, which was known as Grenada. Is there a particular line or scene from that film that is memorable to you? I know you just quoted a few there.
You ready for it?
Yes.
I'm going to do it in a Sean for you, just for you.
All right.
This is the AK-47 that has a distinctive sound and fire when it is fired. Get to know your enemy's weapon.
I love that. That is a great scene and a great, great quote. What about any of these other ones like Platoon, Little Shop of Horrors, any of these? How about Golden Child? You touched on that earlier, and Three Amigos.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great film. I think, look, that was one of Eddie Murphy's lesser-known ones internationally, out here in Australia at least. It took off on VHS. I actually love that film. You could really rewatch that a number of times. And, of course, you've got the best villain in the world. I mean, who does better than this British actor who just comes in and steals the show every time? We're talking about a guy who was great in Alien 3, Last Action Hero, stole the roles, you know? I mean, you know, the whole idea of him doing that scene with Anthony Quinn, he goes, what have you done? You've done a 360 on me. No, I just did a 180, you spaghetti slapping moron.
Yeah. Of course, no, it had James Hong, who we had seen earlier in
Big Trouble.
Yeah, Big Trouble, Little Triumph. Thank you. We were just talking about that.
Thank you, Mr.
And of course, one of my favorite character actors of all time and Highlander television alumni, Mr. Randall Tex Cobb.
Oh, yes. Look, Randall's one of those guys who is the genuine ass kicker. I mean, he was in kickboxing tournaments in the late 70s and early 80s. A lot of people don't know that.
That's right. You actually brought that to my attention a couple specials ago. I remember that, yeah.
And when you track that down, listeners, on YouTube, just have a look. He doesn't have the finesse and style, but boy, he's got that body weight behind every kick. So if you get hit by it, you're going down.
That's right.
You're going down.
Well, when it comes to the top box office films in this quarter here, we had Platoon come in at number 3 behind Top Gun and Crocodile Dundee. And then we had Star Trek coming at number 5, and we had The Golden Child coming at number 8. Of these films released in the last quarter of 86, did a lot of money and came at the top 10. And I want to ask you real quick, before we wrap this up here, we got the 1986 Academy Awards. The best movie was Platoon. Director was Oliver Stone, Platoon. Best actor was Paul Newman of Color of Money. Actress was Marley Matlin from Children of a Lesser God. And one of your favorites, best supporting actor, Michael Caine in Hannah and Her Sisters. And the best supporting actress was Diane Wiest. Do you have any comments about the Oscar winners there?
Oh, look, at the end of the day, Michael Caine is the only Oscar winner worthy of note.
That's awesome. I love it when you do your Kane or Connery bits. Those are great. Well, speaking of, please tell our listeners here on the Fandom Podcast Network how they can find you, listen to you, and basically stalk you on social media.
If you want to stalk the Alan, the R, and the Ryan, you can catch him at osfansradionetwork.poppy.com. If that's too slow for you, I'll do it even faster. There you go. That's it. That's where you can. No, catch us on facebook.com/osfansradionetwork. You'll find all the shows on there. You'll also find all news. You'll find some stabs at Radio Nerd, stirring him up. It'll be all on there with nice little videos of Radio Nerd dancing and breakdancing.
I love this, bro. He's a breakdancer.
That's true. It's true. We'll have more on there for you. And
awesome.
We've also got Twitter. You can catch us at the Twitter handle of @ARRyan_writer, where you can catch my writing, you can catch my thoughts on all things geekdom, and a little bit of comedy, and maybe even a little bit of Sean.
Nice, nice. Well, I want to thank you for coming on. I know we've been missing each other, but I really appreciate you making time for us, and just thank you for everything you've done for me, and hopefully we'll see you come over here stateside one of these days.
Now, you've heard that here first, listeners. That's right. Alan R. Ryan will be bringing the Stampinator with him to the States a little bit later than expected. It will probably be in the second half of the year of 2017. And we may just bring the Harris from the Harris Palace, which is not much of a palace. No, no, stirring you up, Harris. There you go, buddy. The Harris man, after he survives his ordeal of watching Fury Road strapped to a chair at the Blair Hiscock Film Studios.
You have been warned, America. We are going to be invaded by the Fury Road of our Oz fans, friends, and family.
Immorta! Immorta! Witness!
Well, Alan, thank you very much for coming on, and we'll have you again on soon, and I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
All right. Thank you, man. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
See you, man.
All right. Thank you so much, Alan. I really appreciate you. We've been trying to get him on, and I knew – and that's one thing I love about Alan. He's a huge film fan like I am, and there's so many movies that he and I go back and forth on. And I've been a guest on his network a lot and really appreciate the time that he's put in on that. And it was an honor to have him on this show. Now, guys, before we wrap this up, we have to tease 1987 because it's going to be 30 years – in a few months for a lot of the great films that came out in 87. And I'm going to tell you what the top 10 moneymakers were. At number 10 was The Witches of Eastwick. Number 9 was Lethal Weapon. 8 was Stakeout. 7, The Secret of My Success. 6 was The Untouchables. 5 was Moonstruck. 4 was Good Morning Vietnam. And number 3 was Beverly Hills Cop 2. Number 2 was Fatal Attraction, which scared the crap out of every man on the planet.
Responsible for single men across the country.
Yes. And number 1 was 3 Men and a Baby.
That's surprising.
Not really, but...
Norm, what's going through your mind? Tell me.
Well, in our previous episode of this flashback 1986, you know, Aaron was making the case that 87 was a stronger year than 86, but looking at the top 10 money makers, those top 10 money makers are not nearly as influential, in my opinion, to cinema in the 80s as the top 10 money makers of 86.
Well, the number one movie made $10 million less than which is 3 Men and a Baby than Top Gun did in its year.
But if you just like talked to like, say, sample, like 20 people that grew up in this era, what do you think, which movie do you think would just resonate more quickly with them? What did you like better, Top Gun or 3 Men and a Baby?
Mm. You know, what's 3 Men and a Baby for me really surprised me. I know it was a more of a family film, and a lot more people, I think, went to see that because of that. But the movies that jump out
of here. Went to go see it because of Tom Selleck. Yeah. Went to go see it because of Tom Selleck. Let's be honest. You know,
Magnum P.I.
Yeah, the three guys that starred in that movie was Ted Danson coming hot off of Cheers, Tom Selleck, who's hot off of Magnum P.I., and Steve Guttenberg, who's hot off of like the Police Academy.
Short Circuit, too.
In Short Circuit. So I'm not going to say it was a terrible film, but they didn't go because of the story. They went because of the actors.
Yeah, that was definitely a movie that the actors sold that film.
The Secret of My Success, I made the top 10. That surprises me.
That is underrated Michael J. Fox film.
No, it's a great film. It really is. Yeah, it's a great film. I the Untouchables, of course, Sean Connery getting his Oscar finally, right? I mean, that was kind of one of those, we better give him an Oscar. But he was great in that film. Great in that film.
Yeah, but out of all these films, when you take a look at like the entire list, in my opinion, they're like, the two really big breakout films are like Lethal Weapon and Good Morning Vietnam.
Yeah. And Beverly Hills Cop 2, which I will actually argue is a better film than the original. I love Beverly Hills Cop.
Oh, I will 100% disagree with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with Norman on that one.
Oh, I don't know what you're smoking there, dude. Go watch Hoosiers or something.
That's actually another show that I was talking with Aaron about whether or not you believe which sequels were better than the original. So now, that's another show left to touch on here.
Now looking at the list, here's my feeling of why you can make an argument that 87 might be a bigger year than 86. Well, 86 had these big changing films. 87 just throughout the entire year is just known movie. I mean,
it is super consistent.
Let's touch on this here. We've got other notable 87 movies are Angel Heart, Adventures in Babysitting, Blind Date, Broadcast News.
A lot of Mez right there. Yeah. A lot of Mez.
Can't Buy Me Love, Dirty Dancing.
Okay.
Full Metal Jacket, G.I. Okay. Joe the Movie.
Terrible.
What? Inner Space, La Bamba, Less Than Zero,
again,
The Lost Boys,
okay,
Masters of the Universe,
Greatest,
Monster Squad, one of my favorite vampire films, Near Dark, No Way Out, Overboard, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, The Princess Bride,
okay,
Raising Arizona, RoboCop,
okay,
Roxanne, The Running Man, Throw Mama from the Train. Ooh, look, cows. The Living Daylights.
Yes.
Stakeout, The Stepfather, Steel Dawn, Spaceballs, the movie, and mm-hmm. Wall Street, and Wanted Dead or Alive. I threw that in there because it's a Rutger Hauer film.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a great Rutger Hauer film.
Hey, Kevin, you forgot one movie.
Oh, I'm sure I did. What?
Predator.
Yes!
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's a game changer. That's kind of a big oversight right there.
Yeah, that's a game changer right there.
Yeah, it is. That is, yeah. So guys, as we wrap this up here, what is your thought? First of all, real quick, Norm, favorite film of 86?
Of all time? 86?
86.
Oh, it's going to have to be Big Trouble in Little China.
Kyle, what about you?
It's close, but Transformers has the warm spot in my heart, but it's got to be Aliens.
Davis, what about you?
I love Transformers and I love Aliens, but Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home.
I'm going between Top Gun and Aliens, but Aliens beats it out. Looking quickly at 87, Norm, you got a favorite out of this list?
Masters of the Universe.
Kyle, what about you?
Oh, RoboCop is always high up there.
What about you, Davis?
Predator.
Yeah, Predator's good.
You know, I went back and forth with Predator, RoboCop. You know, I have to go with RoboCop. That one was that was the film that I can honestly say that desensitized me to violence on the big screen. after I saw RoboCop,
there was nothing else that
really shocked me other than RoboCop. So thank you, RoboCop. I will always be in your debt.
I'll buy that for a dollar.
I might have to change my voice. Princess Bride is there too.
Yeah,
that is an amazing movie right there.
Yeah, that is a good one. Whew, gosh, that's going to be fun to talk about. But we will be doing a fandom flashback for 1987. Thank you guys so much for doing this part four of the Fandom Flashback 1986. However, we've got some other great programming coming from the Fandom Podcast Network. We've got the Culture Clash, our weekly fandom show that I co-host with you, Kyle. It looks like we got some stuff to talk about. We got some Rogue One. We got some movies we've seen.
We've got a little... Apparently,
I hit a hot topic button about how I felt about The Arrival. We'll have to talk about that.
Well, and there were a couple of last-minute announcements today. A lot of rumors about Disney making a run at purchasing Netflix.
Yes, yeah. Netflix is an ongoing topic on the Culture Clash,
and about
touch on that.
And about 4 hours ago, Marvel had a little announcement.
Looking forward to that.
Yeah. Can you say a new TV series is coming on ABC?
We'll tease that. We'll save that for a Culture Clash.
Yeah.
Norm, we do Blood of Kings. We talk about Highlander, taking names and watching them.
Also, breaking news for Highlander. It's official that Highlander will be continuing its storyline from the Connor McLeod story in an ongoing new comic book series that will be starting later next year.
I can't wait. That is so cool. That hey, guess what? We're going to do a show about that, aren't we?
That's right. We bring all things Highlander, including TV shows, the movies, the anime, the audiobooks, the novels, the blah, and the blah, and the blah, and the more, and the more, and the more, and also the new comic book series of 2017.
That's right. Couch Potato Theater, last one we did was Davis and Norman knocked out the last Starfighter. Davis, can you give us maybe a sneak peek of what you might be trying to go for next for our Couch Potato?
So what we've been thinking and looking at, we might be heading toward Flash Gordon, Masters of the Universe, Planet of the Apes, and you don't have to save one of my favorites. Well, I'll save that one for later. I won't spoil anything for that one. But, you know, Tron is also another one that's on the list because I think Alan R. Ryan wants to actually join in with us.
Yes.
Program.
Yes. Now, this is the Fandom Flashback, and, you know, we've covered the year of 1986, but we're looking at the next Fandom Flashback, and Kyle is working hard on the next one. You want to give a tease of what we're going to be talking about on the next
one? Well, 1986 and all this 80s talk got me a little inspired. I don't know if we're going to go dive in deep to four parts, but we're going to have a little fun because I'm going to bring this group of guys from this episode back because, gentlemen, we're going to talk some lost 80s TV shows.
Nice.
Now,
nice.
I can dig it.
Now, we all know about the big hits. We know Cosby Show, Cheers. You know, you want to talk about Dallas or Falcon
Family
Crest,
Ties.
Family
Ties. Magnum P.I.
But yeah, exactly. We know the big hits. But, you know, when you look at 80 shows, you got to look at it too. 80 shows kind of break down. You have the big hits. You have the cult classic hits. That's where you're going to have things like your A-Team and your Knight Rider. Things people know, but they maybe have forgotten about for a little bit of reasons. But you have so many shows in the 80s that had short runs, but were so good. And
can you give us a quick lowdown on a few?
Oh, absolutely. A couple I know Norman will be all over is Street Hawk and The Master.
I'm so on The Master. That's my show. That is my show.
Max Headroom, right? You got Max Headroom.
Max Headroom. I'm all over Max Headroom. That is so, that is something for me. But some oddball series, too. You have a show from CBS called Otherworld, and I don't know if you guys remember that or not. You also had some shows in the early 80s that were based off of 70s properties. You had the Planet of the Apes TV show. You also had, and this is timely considering what's going on, the show Beyond Westworld.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So,
oh, dude, you've got Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew Mysteries.
Oh, yeah.
Susan Day. Oh, my God. Yeah. Come on. Are you kidding me? Susan now, Day was so hot back in the day.
Simon.
Yes. Now, and another one that I know is very close and has personal meaning to both Norman and myself is Voyagers.
Yes, the great John Eric Hexum, Mino Palouse time travel show. This is way before time travel was hot.
Yeah. Okay,
way before.
Kyle, I want to say, being the football fan, thank you so much for putting in the George Michael Sports Machine on Sunday night.
The other thing too that we'll talk about in this episode, and I want to mention this because I think it's something. The 80s were very much had a lot of anthology type shows that were kind of played on a little bit of the horror angle, where you had shows like Friday the 13th, Freddy's Nightmares, Tales from the Dark Side, Tales from the Crypt, and you had those horror genre ones. But there was one that I was always a huge fan of, and Kevin, I know you were a huge fan of too. And this was an NBC show with a little help from Mr. Steven Spielberg, and that was Amazing Stories.
Yes.
Now, there were so many good ones, but there was actually one show from Amazing Stories that actually got spun out because of its episode on Amazing Stories. Any of you guys know what that show was?
No.
It's animated. Family Dog.
Is that right?
That was originally on Amazing Stories, and it was so popular that they spun it out into its own series. Look it up, guys.
That's awesome. That's going to be a fun series to do because there is a lot of good stuff you got on that list. So thank you for starting that, Kyle, and great suggestion too. I want to mention real quick that we touched earlier on Highlander. Davis, Kyle, and our friend of the show, Aaron Gill, we're going to be at the Lakeland, Florida Highlander LashCon Events Convention, the Highlander 30th Anniversary Convention in December 3rd through 4th. And we're going to have a Blood of Kings meetup there on the Friday night before, and we'll put that information out there. But I just want to put that out there because we're really excited about Highlander. You can find all of these great shows on the Fandom Podcast Network on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Google Play, Facebook, Fandom Podcast Network, and also we have the Blood of Kings, a Highlander fandom group, and the Blood of Kings Highlander CCG collectible card game page. Email us at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. We're also at bloodofkingspodcast@gmail.com. Instagram, Fandom Podcast Network, and also Blood of Kings Pod. On Twitter, you can find us at FanPod Network and Blood of Kings Pod. Kyle, where can we find you on Twitter?
I'm easy to find on the Twitter. It's at AKyleW.
Norman, where can we find you?
You can find me at Starfighter1701. Excuse me.
And you're also on Instagram as well under that.
Yes, at Starfighter1701.
Davis, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Davis Grayson.
My name is Kevin. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Spartan_Phoenix. I'd like to thank all of my guests and co-hosts that have participated in this awesome special four-part presentation of the Fandom Flashback 1986. We had the lovely Miss Amy Nelson, lovely Aaron Gill, Alan R. Ryan, thank you so much for coming in on this one as well. And of course, my fellow Fandom Podcast buddies, love you guys. Norman, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it, man.
It was great. Great to live these 1986 memories, and maybe we'll explore a little bit more.
Yes. Davis, thank you again. An awesome job on the toys, man. That really brought back some great memories.
Thank you, sir. I really do appreciate it. And like Norm said, maybe we can go further down the rabbit hole.
Yeah. Kyle, man, thank you again, dude. This has been a great ride. And I'm always amazed by the little tidbits of knowledge you know about all this stuff, man. Thank you again.
Yeah, and I don't think we're done with the 80s. I think we got 87 to talk about. And I think the 80s are in for a big hit in popularity, because next year there's a little movie that I know we're all very excited about that's coming out. And I think I'm ready for Player One.
Ready Player One. If you are an 80s fan of any kind, got to check out that book. Thank you, Normie. Thank you so much for joining me on this special look back on favorite year in movies in 1986. We've debated whether or not that is the best year or not. We've made a case. Maybe not. Maybe. We'll see for 1987. Join us here on the Fandom Podcast Network for the next installment of Fandom Flashback. Until next time, I'm Kevin, and I'll see you in 1987. Goodbye.